Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, May 14, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you are listening live over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449-389. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, tonight's scriptures, I guess we'll pick up where we left off. We were in Matthew 26, let's see where we read to. We were in Matthew 27, verse 31, I believe. Give me a minute to open my Bible here. Okay, Matthew 27, and I believe we left off at verse 31. Okay, I think we left off at 31. Let me take a quick look, though, here and read a few of these verses. Okay, no, I think we left off at verse 10. Okay, so we'll pick up verse 11. And Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, saying, "Art thou the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said unto him, "Thou sayest." And when he was accused of the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then said Pilate unto him, "Hearest thou not how many things they witness against thee?" And he answered to him never a word, insomuch that the governor marveled greatly. Now at that feast, the governor was wont to release unto the people a prisoner whom they would. And they had then a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, "Whom will ye that I release unto you? Barabbas or Jesus, which is called Christ?" For he knew that for envy they had delivered him. When he was set down in the judgment seat, his wife went unto him, saying, "Have thou nothing to do with this just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said unto them, "Whether of the twain will ye that I release unto you?" They said, "Barabbas." Pilate saith unto them, "What shall I do with this, with Jesus, which is called Christ?" They all say unto him, "Let him be crucified." And the governor said, "Why? What evil hath he done?" But they cried out the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." When Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but that rather a turmoil was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person. See ye to it." Then answered all the people and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." Then released he Barabbas unto them. And when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the common hall and gathered unto him the whole band of soldiers. And they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. And when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head and a reed in his right hand. And they bowed and bowed the knee before him and mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spit upon him and took the reed and smote him on the head. And after that they had mocked him, They took his robe off from him and put his own raiment on him and led him away to be crucified. Okay, that was Matthew 27. We read from verse 11 through 31. Okay, let's see. Tonight we're going to take a look at a few things. You know, we've written a couple of papers to be sent out probably in the next day or two. Pretty much got them mostly completed today. It needs to be perfected, and we might change some things in it. But I'm going to read pieces of it. It's too long to read all of it. It's actually two papers. They're both about 19 pages long, 18 pages long, something like that. And they're an answer to the orders that the court put out. We asked for a couple of things, and not that we asked, we moved the court, or demanded of the court a few things. One of the things, you know, we took notice, you know, we really never looked at this close enough, but we always knew that the paperwork was a problem. I know I've become more and more convicted that it's a bigger problem than we realize. The paperwork that you file out in order to file a case in any court says on the very front page of it, a civil case. Even the paperwork that is also printed out for us, which is the summons, usually the clerk prints that out, even that says civil court on it. Civil means statutory. And so even though we have taken our papers and we have been very careful to maintain our jurisdiction by using all the proper language within the paperwork, such as, you know, we called it at law, which, you know, Black's Law Dictionary says is common law, and the Supreme Court, of course, has ruled that. That's common law. Also, you know, we make note of the fact that we're the people, we're in our own person, and that we come before the court for a court of record. And so we're looking to be into a court of justice. We also make the point that we expect and intend in being in a Article II court, which is the constitutional court under Article II of the Constitution. It tells the jurisdiction of the court. And so that's an Article II court. I've heard people talk about an Article I court, and we've talked about that in the past, and that's nonsense. No such thing as an Article I court. These people, you know, the lawyers make all kinds of things up. You know, one of the problems, of course, we have and is we're dealing with lawyers. We're trying to get a law to be upheld by bar attorneys who believe that statutes are law. And so that indeed is a major problem, and that's the hill that we have to climb. Well, we kind of always known that, of course, but that's where we're at. And no matter what happens, this is a New York case we're talking about, the gun issue, the SAFE Act issue. And, you know, even if we were to not be able to prevail in this case, we still have a case that we can then put into also added on to the subversion to prove the subversion, to prove the collusion or the subversion, the conspiracy between the judges and even some, of course, legislators. Of course, a lot of these legislators that created a lot of this law, this goes way, way back. Most of them are dead. But, you know, one of the problems is not so much that the Congress is writing bad law. Somehow they've been convinced that, you know, some group of lawyers have got to write the law, and they're given the law to read and pass, and usually no one even knows who wrote it. You know, I've heard the complaints many times where the Congress would say, well, we haven't even had time to read it, you know, but we got to pass it because it's so important and it's an emergency. Of course, we haven't heard about that in a while, thankfully, but we've heard that. And so lawyers have been writing, bar lawyers have been writing these laws that have been controlling ultimately the law and has turned common law over in and removed it from our memory, and has moved in Roman law, civil law, Babylonian law, Justinian law, civil law. They all mean the same thing. You look it up in Black's Law, they all mean the same thing. And so that's the law of man. It comes from Babylonia, Babylon. It's Babylonian law. And the whole process is to enslave the people, to control the people. That is really the whole point of their law, is to maintain control. There is really only one true law, and we have gone through studying the Black's Law, looking at all the law, and I forget exactly how many different courts there are. I think there's like 49 or something, or close to that number, different courts. And but there's only one court of law. Only one court, and it can only be one court of law. That's the law of God, because only the law of nature's God is possible to make the only law that would be righteous. And through that law, in obedience to that law, and in holding up that law, covenanting with God concerning that law, as we did in the Declaration of Independence, all those things, you know, that brings us in to the law of the land, and it cannot be defeated. Okay, when you read the Constitution very carefully, and maybe in our papers we might make this point, I don't remember, but we've probably made it in the past, and if we haven't, we'll make it in the future. But generally speaking, when you read the Declaration of Independence and combine it, of course, and that's built off the Magna Carta, and of course, Magna Carta comes off the common law, and so we've got the Declaration of Independence, which is the foundation of our nation. It is a law. A lot of people don't recognize that the Declaration of Independence is one of the first. And we know it's the first founding paper, but people don't think about it as being the law. We quote it often in our paperwork because it has law. It is the foundation, the fundamental, the beginning of law. Then we have the Constitution, which is the framework of our law, and that particular law is the law that our servants must be obedient to. We, the people, ordained and established that law. And then, of course, there is the Capstone Bill of Rights, and that ultimately identifies with the liberties that God has blessed us with, and there's many, many more than the Ten Amendments, many, many more. And so there it is, our law, right there in a nutshell. Common law really is the law of the heart. You know, the Lord told us that he wrote his law in the heart, into the heart. But we know right from wrong. I mean, there are exceptions to the rule. There are people whose consciences have been seared, okay? And you know, they have no empathy for others. Maybe they're cold killers, maybe they're serial killers, and whatever. And they don't necessarily be a killer, but there's a lot of people that have had their conscience seared. And I think lawyers are very close to have that being done academically. But in any event, generally speaking, most people, the bulk of the people, and also even these people that you know, continue to do evil and have no empathy for others, even they do know what's right from wrong. They know what they're doing is wrong, and they do it anyway. So again, our law is written in the heart. And the common law is really all about discovering the truth, to discover if there's an injury, to discover if there was an injury, who created that injury, and then how can we restore that individual. That's the point of common law. And the main, really, if you were to sum up common law in just a few words, it would simply be, do no harm. Has a harm been committed? Do no harm. It's that simple. It doesn't get any more difficult than that. And 12 people in a room trying to listen very closely to the witnesses and figure things out, you know, after a while you see through the lie, you see through you see the truth, you see the contradictions, you see what is obvious, And those people could usually can figure it out. And I would say probably most of the time they could figure it out. And in very rare occasions where maybe they're kind of stuck and they can't move, it's not up to the judge to dismiss that jury and call a mistrial. That's not up to the judge at all. He doesn't have that authority or power. The only power or authority he's been given is to tell those people, get back into the room until you figure it out. And no matter how long they have to stay there, doesn't matter. Just go back and figure it out. And if you can't come to a conclusion, then maybe you have to compromise and agree to let this individual go, to not prosecute, to not find him guilty. But the jury is the ones to decide everything. And so common law doesn't get much more difficult than that. Statutes or statutory law is very boring and involved, and there's a lot of legalese going on, and the legalese is all there to enslave us, and that's what it's all about. And I'm telling you that these courts, from the federal courts right down to the state courts or even the county courts, they're the only three basic courts that I'm aware of that are courts of record. I mean, there are some other courts, like, you know, they claim that family court is a court of record, at least they do here in New York, and that's the biggest joke ever. It's the worst court system in all of New York State is the family court, in my opinion. But in any event, there are certain courts that do require statutes. The bankruptcy court, the job has been given Congress to write statutes in order to control the law process for bankruptcy. Congress was also given the job to write the rules for the court. And quite some time ago, if I understand from what I was reading, they did. But it didn't work out too well because they weren't lawyers and they didn't know how the court went. And it wasn't so much that they weren't lawyers, but they didn't understand how the court system went. A lot of these people, they don't even know what the Constitution has to say. They're so easily pushed over. So at some point, there was some... who was he? He was an attorney general, and I forget what state, but he made a statement that the courts, the Supreme Court, when they say the Supreme Court, I presume they mean the United States Supreme Court. But from reading these things, it assumes like there was a meeting of the federal district courts and maybe along with the Supreme Court. I don't know. Maybe the Supreme Court finalized the blessings on it. I don't know. But what they did is Congress turned the job over to the court system to write the rules of the court. They did put a few things that were very clear in there and are very, very important in the very beginning, and then they let them loose. And these people have written the rules with so much legalese and so much confusion and hiding so many things in there that it really has taken away our common law process away from us. One of the things we see, pro se litigant after pro se litigant being cast out constantly out of the court is for not having a claim that they claim is recognizable, So that's one of the big things that they throw them out with. And believe you, it's all about just getting the people out of the court, maintaining the status quo. And another thing they do is they usually give the other side more time. I know in this case, in the New York case, they asked by letter that they wanted more time. They asked for 45 days. We objected to that, and we denied that, and we wrote a letter because the judge immediately, the very next day, approved that time. But they didn't make a motion, and yet the court made an order. And a court can't move without a motion. That is true. A court can move on its own. That is true. But not on behalf of the plaintiff or the defendant. They cannot move on a motion on behalf of them. The court can put an order if there's a particular problem or situation. And, of course, we're talking about equity courts here. Ultimately, common law courts, ultimately, which would be a court of record, that is a jury trial. And the judge should have no say whatsoever. But they put out five orders. We first off told them that we wanted our money back. We gave them the $400, and that the only reason we paid it was because we couldn't get in here without paying it. So now that we paid it, we want it back. And that was extortion. They extorted money from us. They didn't like that word. They even made that point to using that word, extortion. But anyway, they don't want to give us the money back. And by paying that $400, really puts us again. It's another lock into the civil court. And remember, the you have two pieces of paper. Once you fill out all your papers and you've got all your T's crossed and your I's dotted and you know, you're ready to go forward. You got everything ready to maintain and hold your jurisdiction. The moment you serve it, because you have to fill out a paper, which is a cover sheet. It's a civil cover sheet, bringing you into a civil case. That just changed the jurisdiction. Also, the summons says civil. It's a civil paper. It says civil court. And again, it fortified the fact that you're back into that civil court. So, of course, what we did is we filed papers to correct all this stuff. And we told the judge and the magistrate that we expect to have a court of record under the common law and one that operates under as an Article III court. We're in the federal courts. We want an Article III court. That is the only court approved in the Constitution. There is none other. None other. Yet, their rules created courts. It created a criminal court. It created a civil court. And also, at least here in New York, they've unified the courts, so it's created all kinds of courts. They're all administrative courts. It's what's called Nisi Prius courts. They have no power and no authority to fine or incarcerate. Yet they do, and they will continue to fine, and they will continue to incarcerate until we, the people, stop them. And, of course, that's what we're trying to do, is stop them. We have to hit critical mass, and we do have one thing on our side, and that is the swamp being drained, a lot of different things. So the stage or the positioning is really being set for us to get that access at some point. But we have to continue to press towards the mark and continue to go forward. But anyway, we now filed these papers, and then we had to fill out those papers. So now we corrected that. We want our money back. We want them to correct the records. This is a common law court. We're in here we're under the rules of the common law, not under the rules of chancery, as the rules have created. The rules have not, when they were given authority for rules. Let me see if I can find this quickly. Well, you know what? I'm not going to find it at the moment. I'll pick it up as I go through these papers. I'm not going to read all these papers, but I'm going to read pieces of these papers, and we're going to talk about the rules and the courts that these people created by these rules, and what the rules were really for, what they were to do, and in opposed to what they did do. Okay. So we filed two papers today. Well, we actually wrote two papers. We've been working on them for days now, and we finally finished them today. But again, it has to be perfected. May make some changes. So it may not get out tomorrow, but maybe Wednesday we'll get it out and file the papers and get everybody a copy of their papers, and then we'll post it up online. When we post it up online, we'll send a note out. We'll also post the orders that these judges put out. We haven't posted that yet. We've got a couple of papers, orders from the judge, one from the judge and one from the magistrate. We'll post that, and then we'll post our answers in response to it, okay? And so let me see if I could find where we might want to look. We'll start with this. Two papers we filed. One, of course, was a response, which we put together as a show cause concerning motions in error, okay? And motions in error is a process you could use. We discovered that in Black's Law. So we'll use that. It's a common thing. When a motion is approved and there was an error that got that motion approved, you filed what's called a motion in error. And in this case, we're filing a show cause concerning a motion in error because it's more than an error. It's really subversion is what it is. But we don't want to outright call it that yet. although eventually we will bring that point up. And I think one of our papers sort of hint to it, maybe both of these papers a little bit hint to it, because we do want them to understand we're not going to stand for their subversion anymore, and we're going to do things. Okay, one of the things they did was they made a motion to dismiss, okay? And now the motion wasn't really dismissed. They asked for permission to have 45 days to put forward a motion to dismiss, okay? And I'm going to read one of the responses we have. Oh, let me tell you what the second paper is. The second paper is written from the grand jury. It's called A Brief of Amicus Curiae. I believe that's the proper pronunciation. Amicus Curiae, which is a paper that could be written by someone who has an interest in the case, and they're not part, one of the parties, they're not part of the people, but they become part of the party by putting in a paper and to support a particular position. And in this case, we put in a brief of Amicus Curiae, a unified United States common law grand jury, the King's Bench in a court of record, in support of the plaintiffs. So the grand jury is coming in both as an ex-friend or as the sureties of the peace. In both cases, we put both those notes down there. Now, I'm going to read this now, just a few pieces here or there. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Like I said, it'll take way too long. But once we get it up, everybody have the opportunity to read it on their own. And hopefully tonight we'll get some questions on this, we'll get some conversation going on this, and hopefully more once we file the papers and people get it and they ask questions, hopefully. Okay, this is, I'm going to read pieces of the brief of Amicus Curiae. And here we've got motion to dismiss. So let me go back, maybe we'll go one before that. I see another one before that. Hold on. Okay, jurisdiction and filing fees. Oh, one of the things, when we told them we wanted to come into a court of record, and we showed them all the law and everything on it, they denied it. They put an order out denying us to have a court of record under the law of the land. I cannot believe that this judge is that dumb. I just cannot believe it. I'm perplexed. But, you know, I know they got to do something, and they got to figure a way, but they're throwing someone under the bus. There's no doubt about that. Okay, this is what part of the things is. It's an argument we have concerning jurisdiction and filing fees. 28 U.S. Code, subsection 1914, requires a filing fee for civil cases. Civil law and Roman civil law are interchangeable, serving the same system of jurisprudence, distinguished from the common law. By the way, we have footnotes on every one of these points. I'm not going to read the footnotes, but, you know, we don't make any statement without some support and backup on where the authorities come from. So we have an authority on every phrase, every word we use here. Plaintiffs clearly filed an action of law under the jurisdiction common law under American jurisprudence, where justice is free. History shows that natural law, also known as common law, finds its roots in the book of Exodus, where we find a covenant between God and man, a covenant that was renewed via the Declaration of Independence. And by the way, as I read this, you know, it hasn't been perfected for errors, so, you know, sometimes as you read out loud, you discover, you know, the odd speech, or didn't get the thought out right, or whatever. In contrast, Roman law, also known as civil law, finds its roots in Babylon, that God called an abomination, where man thinks he can create law that enslaves subjects and serves tyrants like Nebuchadnezzar, and not God through statutes. Civil law is repugnant to the law of the land. Now, in Article 4, we quote in Clause 2, it says here, shall be the supreme... I might as well read the whole paragraph. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuit thereof, and all the treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state, to the contrary, notwithstanding. And then we put in quite a few on here. We've got about three or four U.S. decisions here. One was Marbury versus Madison. Another one was Miranda versus Arizona. And these are very big cases, very well-established cases. Hoak versus Henderson. And we also put in here Article 3, Section 1, where it says that judges both of the Supreme and Inferior Courts shall hold their office during good behavior. And when they go up against the Constitution and they deny your jurisdiction, we have an unalienable right to decide what jurisdiction we want to go into. We can go into an administrative jurisdiction if that's what we want. And there are some cases where I think that's beneficial, certainly not with these people. But there are lots of administrative courts that might be something we might want to get to, you know, use for whatever purposes. Nevertheless, it's up to us what jurisdiction we get to choose. Constitution tells us that we have, there's only two courts. One court. There's only two processes of law. Equity, okay, under American jurisprudence, okay, and common, which is under common law, and of course law, which is the law. Ultimately, it's the law of God. Those are the two jurisdictions in one court. They created many courts. They created a civil court. They created a criminal court. They created they're administrative courts, and those are all administrative courts anyway. Okay. But basically, those are the two. They call them equity courts also, but equity not under the common law. But let me read on here. We then read the findings. The grand jury finds that Magistrate Christian H. Hummel, by rejecting the law of the land, denying due process, guilty of fraud in the court, is in violation of his oath and therefore in bad behavior. We demand that Magistrate Christian F. Hummel withdraw his unlawful order and correct the records or recuse himself. Magistrate Christian F. Hummel has 5 days to obey. Now, last time we gave them so many days to respond, they did respond in a few days that we gave them. So let's see what they're going to do with this one. We threw these people really an olive branch with this because he's already violated the law, but we're giving him that second chance, that opportunity to correct his error, to do right. You know, we want to also consider mercy and always bring that olive branch. But there gets a point when of no return, and that's it. We've had it with them people. And after these two papers, if they don't do the right thing, we've had it with these people. We are going to bring this issue before the grand jury and ask for an indictment. We go on the next, motion to dismiss. Now, this is discussing the points that they always make motions to dismiss. They constantly throw us out of the court. They never get to hear the case because they don't want it to be heard. They got to maintain the status quo. On April 17, 2018, the defendants requested 45 days to file the motion to dismiss via a letter. On April 18, 2018, U.S. District Judge May D'Agostino blindly and unlawfully wrote an order granting defendants pre-motion letter. They sent a letter, and they called it, the judge calls it a pre-motion letter, okay? Seeking leave to file a motion to dismiss and an additional 45 days to file the motion to dismiss. There are no rules or law that provides for a so-called pre-motion letter. And that's just the first point. It doesn't exist. We've been through the rules and we've gone through the statutes and to the best that we can find, definitely in the rules. And they always point to the rules. They point to Rule 12, by the way. And we're very familiar with Rule 12. First and paramount in common law, by the law of the land is more clearly intended the general law, a law which hears before it condemns, which proceeds upon inquiry and renders judgment only after trial. Okay, and that's a U.S. Supreme Court decision. U.S. District Judge May D'Agostino unlawfully granted by order, she made an order, the defendant's request for leave of court of 45 days to file a motion to dismiss. This unlawful act did not relieve defendants of Rule 12, which states, you know, I can't believe they use these rules and they misinterpret these rules so badly. I mean, you know, even the judge responded in the paper that we had sent that it was clear in Rule 12. Well, it is clear in Rule 12, but not what he's saying, what she's saying it means. But anyway, gave him 45 days. The unlawful act did not relieve the defendants of Rule 12, which states a defendant must serve an answer within 21, and in this case, 30 days. In 21 days, if they personally get served. If you give it to the doorkeeper, you know, or bring it to the house, and someone else gets it and from that, you know, wherever it is, the place of business or whatever, then they get 30 days. After being served with the summons and action, there are no lawful or unlawful rules or statutes that empower a judge or magistrate to give defendants more time to answer the action. I mean, in common law, it's reason, you know, someone's had a death in the family, you know, you lost a child or had some kind of an emergency or you lost a parent, and, you know, of course you're going to give them more time. Who would argue with that? Okay? But they had no reason. They didn't even ask for anything. Nothing. Okay? Under Rule 7, it says concerning motions and other papers, a request for a quarter must be made in writing by motion. So here, in order to put out an order, for a court order to respond to the defendant or to the plaintiff, and to respond with an order on behalf of that, whichever side he's given the order for, you know, against or for, one or the other, he can't do that in his own motion, in his own movement. He's got to be moved. The court, either I move the court, you know, the defendants move the court, or the plaintiffs move the court. It's that simple. And again, there are cases, there are situations where a judge can make an order without a motion, but it cannot benefit or deny either of the parties, okay? And so there is the second mistake that they made. Was it the third? It might even be the third one here. So it must be in writing, by motion, must state with particularly the grounds for seeking the order, okay? Haven't put anything grounds, and state the relief sought. Orders cannot be made via a letter to the judge or magistrate. Defendants did not make a motion in writing, nor did defendants state with particularity the grounds for seeking the order. Rule 12B states a defendant must serve an answer. A motion asserting any of the following defenses are the only defenses that may and must be made before pleading, if a responsive pleading is allowed. Now, this is very interesting. You know, because they want to make a motion for dismissal. Well, they have to do it. What this is saying, ultimately, and combined with the other Rule 12 and Rule 7, you combine them together, what it is saying is they will get more time in order to make their motion to dismiss. They need to do that right away. They need to do that in a day or two or three, motion to dismiss. And the judge needs to respond quickly with that, okay? And they have to be preparing to answer. And there's only a few situations where they can get their motion to dismiss approved, and we're going to look at them very, very quickly. If a pleading sets out a claim for relief that does not require a responsive pleading, an opposing party may assert at trial any defense to that claim. So any other defense or any other motion to dismiss or needs to be made, could be made at the trial or right before the trial. But first, the answers have got to be given. They have to answer. They have to respond. There are no provisions in the rules or law allowing more time, nor can an order be made without a motion requesting such an order. Now, here are I think, let's see, is it four things or five? I think it's a few. It's six or seven, okay? And they can't get us for any of them. Lack of subject matter jurisdiction. This court has subject matter jurisdiction over the law and the facts. See Article 3, Section 2. This federal court in this district has subject matter jurisdiction. Lack of personal jurisdiction, personam jurisdiction. Defendants are government officials that acted under the color of law in Albany County within the Northern District of New York, Albany County, which is where the event took place. This court has personal jurisdiction. They can't make either of those points they cannot use to have us cast out. 3, improper venue. Albany County within the Northern District of New York is the state capital where the defendants under the color of law violated the plaintiff's unalienable rights. Therefore, plaintiffs filed in the proper venue. That's where the crime was committed. So we got the right venue. We got the we got personal jurisdiction over them. We got subject matter jurisdiction over them. Insufficient process. Process was sufficient service by the Albany County Sheriff, or insufficient service of process. Those are kind of combined. Service by process was sufficient service by the Albany County Sheriff. So we had the Albany County Sheriff serve these papers, because that's one they play with all the time. And so they can't get out on that one either. Next, failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. And this is where they make it mean whatever it is they want it to mean, okay? The United States Supreme Court has ruled numerous times, and again has built upon, it builds upon American jurisprudence. Good law builds upon American jurisprudence, principles of law, okay? And these judges are to be obedient to that American jurisprudence and to rule according to American jurisprudence. They don't get to rule what they think they want to rule. They get to rule according to American jurisprudence. And the United States Supreme Court is supposed to make sure that they behave. And we're going to notify them of their misbehavior. We'll see what they're going to do about that, but we're going to make notification to them also. But anyway, failure to state a claim. The general rule in appraising the sufficiency of a complaint for failure to state a claim is that a complaint should not be dismissed unless it appears beyond doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claim which would entitle him relief. Now, they cannot make that statement. That is the expression and meaning of failure to state a claim upon which a relief can be granted. And what I was going to say before about the United States Supreme Court, they have ruled numerous times that the only thing necessary for a prima facie case is an affidavit. They also tried to remove a lot of the people from the case because their signature isn't on the motion. And we covered that too. There's a lot of stuff. They can't go for that. But anyway, let's go back. The last one is failure to join a party under Rule 19. All parties involved in the action have been joined. There's no one else to join. So these three groups of people, well, shall I say these three parties, singular being one, the governor or the administration, also both houses up there in Albany County, in Albany, New York. So those three parties are the only parties involved. So we have not, failed to join a particular party. So anyway, we write findings. The grand jury finds that Judge May D'Agostino acted with an order without a motion, which shows bias and willingness to hijack this case and unlawfully maintain the status quo. The defendants have not shown by motion any authority by rule, statute, or law that would grant defendants anything. Attorney General Michael McCartan did not need Judge May D'Agostino's permission for a responsive pleading. Attorney General McCartan pre-motion letter serves only as a ruse to deny plaintiffs' right of due process and maintain the status quo by dismissing the action, usually for failure to state a claim for which relief can be granted, thereby denying plaintiffs' unalienable right of due process. Plaintiffs have an unalienable right to be heard, and the defendants, being elected officials, have a duty to speak. In the U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. versus Tweel, we read, silence can only be equated with fraud where there is a legal or moral duty to speak and where an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading. We counsel the officers of this court to obey the law and not fiction of law, which we made lots of notes concerning fiction. There's a lot of stuff we're not reading here. It's I think a lot of it is all powerful, but I'm just kind of looking at the points of the case. And to obey the law and not fiction of law. Fiction of law is something thought to be law but is not. And it's not real. It's fiction. Correct the records to reflect the lawful jurisdiction of an Article III court and order the defendants to answer. We have a third paper we're going to file within a day or two, probably, after we file these two papers. And I'm not going to say what it is. When we file it, we'll post it, and we will definitely talk about it next week. And I think that will be the one that will irritate them the most. I also think it will be the most powerful one and the shortest one. Let's see. Then we quoted lots of cases here. Conclusion. It is the duty of all magistrates to exercise the power vested in them for the good of the people according to the law and with zeal and fidelity. A neglect on the part of a magistrate to exercise the functions of his office when required by law is a misdemeanor. That's a U.S. case. Any judge who does not comply with his oath to the Constitution of the United States wars against the Constitution and engages in acts in violations of the supreme law of the land. The judge is engaged in acts of treason. Again, we have authorities. The orchestrated action between Assistant Attorney General Michael McCartan, Judge May D. Agostino, and Magistrate Christian F. Hummel is a unlawful ruse that both the federal and state judiciaries use to maintain the status quo by unlawfully denying the people access to the courts of justice. It is obvious to those of us who are experienced in the courts of the common aforesaid collusion. We have watched pro se plaintiff after pro se plaintiff have their complaints dismissed by the courts based on the defendant's pretrial motion to dismiss under Rule 12b. Whereas common law is clear that indeed no more than an affidavit is necessary to make a prima facie case, and statutes that violate the plain and obvious principles of common right and common reason are null and void. We, the grand jury, find both Judge May D. Agostino and Magistrate Christian F. Hummel in bad behavior. We grace you with 5 days to correct the record and conduct yourself or submit your recusals. Failure to obey will result in further action by the grand jury. Think not that you will escape justice. People are awakening, critical mass is imminent, and soon the powers that be will not be able to protect you. Stop warring against the Constitution. Obey the will of the people and restore the law of the land in this court. We understand the web that entangles the judiciary, and we offer an escape via obedience. Okay, now there's a lot more in this here that should be read, and again, you'll have to read it your own. But I'd like to really breeze through, and we might kind of be a little redundant on some of this thing. We wrote from two different positions, one from the position of the grand jury coming in as the sureties of peace, as the next friend, or in support of the plaintiff, as the king's bench. And the other one is from the plaintiffs, First thing, right to proceed without cost. Let me see if I'm going to read much of anything in there. Yeah, let's read a little bit of this. Magistrate Christian F. Hummel's unconstitutional order, dated April 26, 2018, clearly provides proof for the plaintiff's case by calling the fee for the Court of Justice a statutory fee and congealed the fact by quoting 28 U.S.C. 1914a, wherein the statute itself establishes the fee as an administrative filing fee for civil cases that are governed by statutes, as opposed to the common law or equity, which is the jurisdiction that the plaintiff opened and is to proceed according to the common law. Let's see if we're going to read much of this. Let's reread some of this, because this is pretty powerful stuff, and some people may not have heard of some of these particular court rulings. People are to have free access to the courts and public offices. Filing fees impede access to justice and services. We have authorities for all this, okay? There's a lot of footnotes here. living as we do under a common law government, under a common government, charged with the great concerns of the whole Union, every citizen of the United States from the most remote state or territories is entitled to free access not only to the principal departments established at Washington, but also to its judicial tribunals and public offices in every state in the Union. Plaintiffs, and this is another case, plaintiffs should not be charged fees or costs for the lawful and constitutional right to petition this court in this matter, in which he is entitled to relief, as it appears that the filing fee rule was originally implemented for fictions and subjects of the state and should not be applied to the plaintiff, who is a natural individual and entitled to relief. American jurisprudence also has to say about this in some older cases but it's American Jurisprudence Constitutional Law, subsection 326. Free justice in open courts, remedy for all injuries. In most of the state constitutions, there are provisions varying slightly in terms, which stipulate that justice shall be administered to all without delay or denial, without sale or prejudice, and that the court shall always be open to all alike. These provisions are based largely upon the Magna Carta, Chapter 40, which provides, now this is written in the law, in constitutional law, subsection 326. In the Magna Carta, Chapter 40, which provides, we will sell to no man. We will not deny to any man neither justice or right. The chief purpose of the Magna Carta's provision was to forbid the king from selling justice by imposing fees or litigants through his courts, and to deal a death blow to the attendant's venal and disgraceful practices of a corrupt judiciary in demanding oppressive gratitudes for giving or withholding decisions in pending cases. It has been appropriately said that in a free government, the doors of litigation already wide open and must constantly remain so. The extent of the constitutional provision has been regarded as broader than the original confines of the Magna Carta, and such constitutional provisions has been held to forbid the selling of justice, not merely by magistrates, but by the state itself. Okay, then there's another one, mandatory notice of claimant's right to the court without fees, and that's in the New York case, and mandatory access into the court, right to proceed without cost, and so on. And there's more. I'm not going to read them all, but there's quite a few more. Let's see. I'll read this part. Access to the court of justice is an unalienable right called due process, protected under the Fifth Amendment and cannot be changed for. Magistrate Christian F. Hummel states that the filing fee is authorized by Congress under 20 U.S.C. 1914. The United States is a Republican form of government, which means we are a nation of law governed by a constitution, not statutes. Our constitution was written, I may have to reword that a little bit, but because they're the ones that are controlled by the constitution. Let me just make a note of that. Okay, nor statutes. Our Constitution was written by we the people, not Congress. Congress cannot legislate beyond what we the people vested on the common law, or what we the people vested or the common law would permit. And since neither the people or the law can permit, 20 U.S.C. 1914 is null and void in its entirety, along with any other statute or act that constructs upon it. Magistrates in the court of record are expected to know the law and their proper role. Ignorance of the law, which everyone is bound to know, excuses no man. Gross negligence is equivalent to fraud, and the failure to exercise ordinary care finds a person culpable. When a magistrate or a judge forces jurisdictions upon the people far into the Constitution, it is nothing less than lawless violence. These federal district courts ought to be courts of justice, constitutionally describes as Article 3 courts, and legislation to the contrary, not any legislation to the contrary, notwithstanding. This is a lawful statute written for elected, appointed, and employed government servants, preventing said servants from changing jurisdictions. That state, 28 U.S.C. Code, subsection 132, creation and composition of district courts. There shall be in each judicial district a district court, which shall be a court of record. And that, of course, is in line with what the Constitution says. Known as the United States District Court, for the district courts of a record proceed under the jurisdiction of common law. Okay? That's what 28 U.S.C. Code, U.S.C. 130, subsection 132 says. Okay, just a couple more things we'll look at, and then we'll move on. See if we're going to read this. Okay. Magistrate Christian F. Humble, unconstitutional order dated April 26, 2018, stated, in order to commence an action in federal district court, a party must file a complaint. The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure specifically indicates that the only permitted pleading is a complaint. A rule is a complaint. Rule 7A provides only these pleadings are allowed: a complaint, an answer to the complaint, an answer to the counterclaim. That's very interesting because they never follow that rule themselves anyway. They always add this other stuff in to kick you out. The system of federal rules began with the Rules Enabling Act of 1934, whereas Congress gave, and this is what we were talking about in the beginning, a little earlier. The system of the federal rules began with the Ruling Enabling Act, 1934, whereas Congress gave the Supreme Court the power to prescribe general rules of practice and procedure and rules of evidence under 28 U.S.C. 2072. Congress did not give, nor can they give, power to create courts foreign to our Constitution, for that is what their rules did. They created foreign courts, courts foreign to the Constitution. They cannot write laws under the color of law or abrogate common law that proceeds according to the rules of the common law and secured by the Seventh Amendment. And that's exactly what they did. They wrote law under the color of law inside these rules. They abrogated the common law, and they proceeded according to the rules of the common law. Now, this was the Enabling Act of 1934. And I think it was 1939. Recently, I think it was Gerard mentioned this to me, that he had heard from somebody, or somebody mentioned this, that in 1939, that's when everything changed, and they no longer proceed according to the common law. And that is pretty much when the rules came out. So that's probably what they were talking about, whoever was sharing that with me. They didn't have the details, at least they didn't give me the details. But it works with what we're reading here. Okay, so that's where it began, and this is what they've done with it. Let's see, let me pick this up. Congress did not give, nor can they give, power to create courts foreign to the Constitution, write laws under the color of law, abrogate the common law that proceeds according to the rules of the common law, and secured by the Seventh Amendment. The jurisdiction for the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure is found in its title, civil. Civil law, also known as Roman law, is not the law of nature, also known as common law, as prescribed in the Declaration of Independence and secured by the Constitution. Therefore, the said rules are for civil cases and not common law cases, and any rule that would violate plaintiff's unalienable right is null and void. And we quoted Marbury versus Madison, null and void. Congress was clear. Now, this is very important because this is the part that they skip. And this is in the very, this is not only quoted in law, this is quoted in the very beginning of the rules also. If you open up the rules, the Federal Rules of Procedure, this is one of the first things you'll read, is a paragraph of the law. It's 28 U.S.C. 2072. And it says here, Congress was clear when it said under 28 U.S.C. 2072, this is what they said, such rules shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right. And they've done nothing but change, modify, abridge. All laws in conflict with such rules, I'm continuing to read the law here, all laws in conflict with such rules shall be of no further force or effect. Marbury versus Madison, null and void. Therefore, were rights secured, now I added this here, and this is Miranda versus Arizona, therefore, where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. Magistrate Christian F. Hummel, Judge, Judge May D. Agostino, and any other judge or magistrate cannot deny the plaintiff's unalienable right of due process in an Article III court. The Supreme Court did not have the authority to legislate civil and criminal courts via rules. Let me reread that. The Supreme Court did not have the authority. And again, I don't know how they put this together. They had committees going or something. They had the federal district judges involved. They probably had guns to some people's head. I don't know. But this is all nothing but assault upon the Constitution. And you read through these rules, I want to tell you there's some really serious, dangerous problems in these rules. The one particularly I think of is called in rem, a process in rem that the IRS uses all the time. The Supreme Court did not have the authority to legislate civil and criminal courts via rules. They actually legislated courts, legislated law, calling them rules, but acting upon them as law, creating jurisdictions foreign to the Constitution. The rules were only intended to provide for, number one, these are the rules were to provide for these two things. Number one, general rules of practice. That makes sense. I agree with that. Let's find and let's, and they got some good general rules of practice. I can't argue with some of that stuff. We'll use them. It's good. Number two, procedure and rules of evidence. Makes a lot of sense to me. That's great too. I have no problem with that. But that's it. That's what the rules were supposed to be. But it became much more than that. Much, much more. This is an assault upon we the people. This is assault upon the United States of America. This is an assault about the Constitution. These people are tyrants and guilty of subversion. And either they're going to start to obey the rules of the true rules of the court, they're going to start to obey the law of the land under the rules of common law. And if they don't, then we need to indict. We need to bring them before the grand jury, and I'm sure we'll get an indictment. Which, by the way, we're going to be bringing these people up for indictment in the next week or two should they not obey the law and let this case continue. And we do have a surprise attack for them, which we're not going to talk about tonight. After it's served and they got it, we'll talk about it next Monday. But we should be able to serve it before the week is out. And but let me finish reading. So it was only intended for those two things. Here's what they added in their law. As long as they did not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive rights. Somehow, they got these magic wands. And anything of ruling from the courts prior to 1939, I don't know where that comes from, but, some lawyers have said this, I guess, they pay no heed. But there's good stuff after that anyway. You know, you can't do away with the legislation that was created in order to covertly create this system. And remember, this is all the minions of the New World Order. They're everywhere. They're in Congress. They're in the administration. Every elected individual refers for counseling to these minions. They're called bar lawyers, okay? Practiced in the bar, believing that statutes are law, ignoring the Constitution, violating it on a daily basis. All judges are lawyers. I mean, I'm sure there's a few cases where one or two may get in, but most judges are bar lawyers, okay? And of course, all the lawyers are now bar lawyers. Occasionally, you get one that's not, but generally speaking, they are. They're minions of the New World Order. But anyway, let's see where we're at here. Okay, it didn't have the authority, general rules, substantive. Okay, whereas the Supreme Court unlawfully created Roman civil administrative courts called courts of equity via said rules and buried all access to we the people's courts of justice. You know, the unconstitutional rules deny access to our courts of justice by requiring the filing of a civil cover sheet that provides for only a civil court. The judiciary denies access to our courts of justice by filling out the plaintiff's summons for a civil action, giving plaintiffs no recourse for access to our courts of justice. Now, again, this is all that they put together. They do this all the time. Look what they did. In order to work with a bank or something, you have to have a Social Security number. In order to go to work, you've got to have a Social Security number. They box you in. In order to drive a car, and they got swarms of code enforcement officers out there to look for you and catch you, but in order to drive a vehicle, a car, an automobile, whatever you want to call it, you need a license. Again, they box us in. This is no different. They're boxing us in. They boxed us in when they stole our right as committeemen to choose our statesmen instead of criminals. And they've taken that over, and they've boxed us into a process that gives us no power, no authority. They've taken control. They've taken control of our judicial process. They've taken control of our grand juries and our trial juries. They've stacked them. They violate them. They tell them that statutes are law. They should all be in jail for this. Okay, let's see. Right to practice law. Maybe I'll cover that one and we'll end. Let me see what else is. A court cannot move without a motion. We've kind of covered some of that, so I'm not going to read any of that. But we did, deal with that from a different perspective. This particular paper we're reading from now is the paper that's coming from the plaintiffs. But I'd like to read the right to practice law. Magistrate Christian H. Hummel unconstitutionally ordered dated April 26, 2018, denying all plaintiffs from speaking in one voice, claiming authority that 28 U.S.C. 1654 somehow prevents this, which states, now here's the code. Here's the code that he used, okay, telling us that we can't work as a team, that we have to have a lawyer. We can only one person, we all have to give an answer. We all have to put signatures, okay? That's what he says that this code says. And appearance personally, which we read it, this is what the code states. Appearance personally or by counsel in all courts of the United States, the parties, that's the key word there, the parties may plead and conduct their own cases personally or by counsel, as by the rules of such courts respectively, are permitted to manage and conduct causes therein. Now, let me read on. The aforesaid code, 1654, does not say one cannot speak for a group, but does say that the parties may plead and conduct their own cases, whereas party is defined as being composed of one or more natural people, as we read from Black's Law. Here's the definition under in Black's Law, also quoted in Bank versus Cook. Again, American jurisprudence right here. Party is a technical word and has precise meaning in legal parlance. By it is understood he or they, by or against whom a suit is brought, whether in law or equity, the party, plaintiff, or defendant, whether composed of one or more individuals, and whether natural or legal persons, they are parties in the writ and the parties on the record, and all others who may be affected by the suit indirectly or consequentially are persons interested, but not parties. Furthermore, the case Burris versus New York City Housing Authority, which is the case they use, this is a housing authority judge, an administrative court down in New York City. You know, I don't know how many people understand what that means. It's a joke. It's a joke. That's what this is a housing authority judge that works, and he's not a real judge either, okay? And he's an administrative, he's like a town judge or a town court judge. He's an administrative judge dealing with housing issues, okay? And we've seen some of these cases down there. But that's where they got the case from. That's where they had to go to pull a case to give an improper interpretation of the meaning of that particular phrase, you know, of that particular code. So that case coming out of New York City Housing Authority is an administrative court and not a court of record. And their interpretation of law is not law, having no place in a court of justice. It's an opinion that does not add to jurisprudence, but in fact is repugnant because, as shown above, their opinion is incorrect. You know, and look, they can quote all the cases they want. Federal judges don't make law. They don't interpret law. And that case is not the same as any other case. Oh, well, it's similar. Well, similar. Is it exactly like it? Nope. It's similar. Well, it's similar. It's not exactly like it. You see? So it's not the same. But besides that, they don't get to interpret law. They don't get to make law. What they get to do is respond according to American jurisprudence. They have to rule as such. Whereas the United States Supreme Court, which does not add to jurisprudence, American jurisprudence, providing it is not repugnant to the Constitution. So every court decision from the United States Supreme Court may not become part of American jurisprudence that these judges are required to act under. Okay? But if it's repugnant to the Constitution, it doesn't get to fit in. And supports the proper interpretation of 28 U.S. Code 1654, as we read. And here's some decisions of the United States Supreme Court concerning what they claim the opposite interpretation is. The term liberty denotes, and again, these are all with authorities. Everything I'm going to read right now is all authorities. It's all Supreme Court rulings, or it might even be already in American jurisprudence. But look at the term. These are all Supreme Court rulings, I'm pretty sure. The term liberty denotes not merely freedom from boldly restraining, but also the right of the individual to contract, to engage in any of the common occupations of life, to acquire useful knowledge, to marry, to establish a home, bring up children, to worship God according to the dictates of their own conscience. The established doctrine is that this liberty may not be interfered with under the guise of protecting public interest by legislative action. Another one. A state cannot exclude a person from the practice of law or from any other occupation in a manner or for the reasons that contravened the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. I really wish they would stick to the Fifth Amendment on that. But here's another case. There can be no sanction or penalty imposed upon one because of exercising his constitutional right. Here's another one. The practice of law cannot be licensed by any state. Here's another one. The practice of law is an occupation of common right. Here's another one. The assertion of a federal right, when plainly and reasonably made, are not to be defeated under the name of local practices. Here's another one. The right to file a lawsuit pro se is one of the most important rights under the Constitution and laws. Here's another one. Litigants can be asserted by unlicensed laymen during judicial proceedings, assisted by unlicensed laymen during judicial proceedings. Here's another one. Turn the page. There's just a couple of more we're going to read. A next friend is a person who represents someone who is able to tend to his or her own interests. Here's another one. Members of a group who are competent non-lawyers can assist other members of the group achieve the goals of the group in court without being charged with unauthorized practice of law. The U.S. Constitution does not give anyone the right to a lawyer, the right to counsel, or the right to
make
any
sure
other
right.
DSA
substitute.
You've got to
complain 100 times.
Gerard, we're hearing you through the mic here. Gerard? Oh. The Sixth Amendment is very specific that the accuser only has the right to the assistance of counsel. And this assistance of counsel can be anyone the accuser chooses without limitations. Therefore, we have a right to counsel each other, and different individuals may take the lead according to our expertise. Additionally, all plaintiffs have sworn affidavits that bear their signatures, and indeed, no more than an affidavit is necessary to make a prima facie case. Okay, I'm going to end it there. But look, we're going to get this up in a few days, and we'll send an email out to notify everybody. And once it's up there, and you should download it and read it carefully. Go through each one of these lines and learn. Understand how these courts are structured, what they're doing, and how you can position yourself. Now, it's very difficult, but, you know, not all these judges are fixers. Remember that. Some of them are timid, and some of them are afraid to take that next big step. Okay? Obviously, we have one that I think probably isn't very bright that says all kinds of stuff. I mean, wow. Guilty of treason on every one of their orders. Okay? We've clearly laid out the truth, and they put statute over constitution. The other judge is quite quiet. He made a few statements in a written thing. He said he sent a letter out. I haven't got it yet. I'm going to probably send it out in a letter. I don't know. But, you know, again, that one's a little more careful, okay? But I can see that one is pushing the magistrate out front and to answer all these things and to deal with these problems and let them be the one that's going to get thrown under the bus. But we're not going to throw one under the bus. We're going to throw them both under the bus if they do not start obeying the law. So we got a lot of things to do to put pressure on them. And we also have things, and we'll move this into our other case if necessary. And we'll ask for indictments. And when we ask for those indictments, there's about 30 or 40, maybe more judges that we have a list of for indictments. That are proceeding forward and not protecting the people from non-judicial foreclosures. We also have certain individuals from mortgage companies who, if we warn that they're breaking the law, we're going to indict them, or shall I say bring them for an indictment. I believe we'll get an indictment. And also other officials, maybe with the county, whoever's in charge of the tax foreclosures. Seems like different states do it differently on different people handling that. So whatever their position is, those individuals. So they're all bringing them all up for the same kind of charges, and we'll probably do those things, ask for an indictment on all those individuals at the same time that we ask for an indictment for these two judges. One's a judge and the other's called a magistrate, but they also call themselves a judge magistrate or a magistrate judge or something. But again, who knows? They may decide to obey the law, and we prefer that and move the case forward and get our day in court. Okay. Jan, if I haven't put you to sleep, are there any questions? Yeah, go ahead, Gerard.
I have a question here from somebody, and this has come up more than one time. And maybe you'll want to address it tonight, or maybe you'll want to do a separate something on it. But this particular person, he says that he's seeking info on transferring my lower court case into our New York court case, but lacked the info on the process. So I know that we have brought people into our case. We always require they do an affidavit. But he's talking about moving his whole case. And I'm not sure, I don't know on that particular case if it's a gun case or what, but it does line up with one of our cases. And I believe he's talking about the master case, not necessarily our gun case, although I may not be right on that. So if somebody wanted to come in under us, I know judges can combine cases themselves. They've done it to us before where they say this case has the same subject matter and I'm going to try them together. But that would require us asking permission. Is there a way that we can bring people in without asking permission under common law, just to attach it to our federal
case? Well, first of all, I don't know that we would want to do that for numerous potential reasons. And we're not perfect. We make mistakes. We're learning all the time. But our paperwork, I believe, is very close to pristine. Do we have any errors? I'm not seeing them. Did we forget something? You know, that's a possibility. But I don't think so either on that. We've really been working at this for almost a decade now, and they've given us a good schooling as we've been going into their courts. We've really understood the game and how they play, and we've really been able to counter them. Now, in order to bring a case in, it can't be personal. It's got to be something bigger. What cases are we really covering? You know, if you look into our cases, we're going after the big cases that are national cases. You know, we got the LaVoy Finnegan murder, and that combined also with the Hammonds and with the Bundys and numerous other people. And so that was a very important case. We wanted to get involved in that, and we did. We're looking at 9/11, a big case, conspiracy, okay? We want to really take a look at that, which hopefully soon we're going to look at that. And I know there's another case I think we're looking at. I forget what it was. But also we have the non-judicial foreclosures. These non-judicial foreclosures, every case operates the same way. They break the same law. They do the same thing. They follow the same process. I mean, that's not an accident, okay? So it proves conspiracy in the judiciary, because that's where we're heading to. We're going after the judiciary eventually. That's where we really need to be. We're going to need more people involved with us, and really we're going to need more money as we're going to need in order to pursue the judiciary, because that's going to be a big case, and we have to file a lot of papers across this nation. There's going to be a lot involved in putting that case together. And again, we're not lawyers, so we're not making millions of dollars. Nobody's making any money here. We're just surviving. That's all we are. We're paying the bills and keeping the lights on and getting the paperwork paid for as far as the paper and the toner and the serving costs and the writing and all this stuff we're putting together. But there is no lawyer here making, $300 an hour or even $50 an hour or even $10 an hour. We don't have any of those things, so that's not here. So the case would have to fit into a case that we would be able to say, okay, and we could take other people into the same category if they came to us, because it does prove the conspiracy, the collusion, the subversion, the RICO across the entire nation and the whole federal judiciary. Okay, that's number one. Number two, their paper would need to be really pristine. We can't afford to lose jurisdiction because of something else said when we put this paper in. Of course, we can go through correcting certain things possibly, you know, and that would take a lot of work. So the likelihood is slim to none, but again, it would depend on ultimately what the case is about and how well it's written. And that would be the two things that would depend upon.
Okay.
It would have to be something that works with what we're doing.
Right, right.
You know, there was a person about a month and a half ago. They wanted us to do something with them for their case, and we told them they couldn't do it. They got upset, but they were a new person. They didn't really understand what we're doing and how we're proceeding here. You know, we're not here to play lawyer, to win cases for people and monetary gain or any of those things. We're not here for those purposes. We're here to deal with the subversion against the United States of America by enemies, both foreign and domestic. And that's within our government right now. These are the problems. The swamp is being drained. We have to drain the judiciary swamp. That's our job.
Well,
that's what
really, what maybe they don't understand is that the problems they're having are already in our case. So that when we prevail on this, then they can point to our case and say, "Hey, look at, see this case here that prevailed? That's the same thing you're doing to me." Because their MO is, I know their MO is the same for everyone. But
yeah, well, they could do, look at, if they study, New York case is a really a good case to study. I want to tell you, it's really a good case. We got a lot of memorandums in there. Memorandums shore up our position, our thinking, who we are, what we're doing. It shores up our positioning, okay? We have a lot of, we cover the problem with jurisdiction versus the common law. We cover the problem with how they keep moving us into another jurisdiction. I remember when we were first learning a lot of this stuff, that lawyer that was teaching us told us that that the federal court is a very difficult place to be, because you'll be moved from one jurisdiction to another as you speak. And so I've always remembered that, and I see it now. I see the game. It's a game of chess, maintaining your jurisdiction. And so you always got to be ready to see, what did they do this time? What did they say this time? What did they refer to this time? How does that affect our jurisdiction, if any? Do I have to deny? Do I have to respond to that word, this phrase? You know, there's just, you got to look at it in an analytical way. And what the question is, did they just change my jurisdiction again? Because that's what they do. You see, if they can change your jurisdiction and end on that note, then they can make their ruling and feel comfortable. Well, they can't get me because I ruled on that jurisdiction. After all, the court was moved at that point in that jurisdiction. They didn't object. So they acquiesced. You see, that's how they think they're saving their skins. But all of that is fraud. It's fraud because they took the rules of the court, created different courts, created laws, and took rules to take them far beyond what Congress gave them the authority to do. Every single rule collectively or individually ultimately, I can't say every rule because there are some good stuff in there. But generally, the rules were written to destroy your ability to stand on an unalienable right. And they want to get you into civil rights. After all, they can give to some and not to others because they're statutory rights. So anyway, anything else for that?
No, that's it. That's good. I just wanted to get that out there so people understand, you know, what we're doing and why and, you know, and how it affects them. Because, they need to pay attention because it does affect everybody. You know, and it's becoming a lot more obvious in the ways that it affects us because every time they repeat their MO, you know, we're not stupid. We learn, you know.
I'm going to take a lot of these issues that we talked about tonight. It's going to be incorporated into the book I'm writing, and it's also going to be incorporated into the course that we're putting together. And I know we wanted to get that course going last month, by the end of last month. It didn't happen. We're here now at the 14th or something. I forget what today's date is. But we're running into the next month, and we're still pushing. These two papers have tied me up for over a week now. And then there's, of course, those two things that I'm writing. I'm working on these papers with others. And I'm also working on two other cases that I'm committed to, so I've really been busy and haven't been able to really put my time into the course to get that course going. But I think maybe soon. Again, it depends on what's thrown here at me and what I got to do. But if I can get a good 5 days without interruption, whether it takes 10 days to get those 5 days out of it, once I can get those 5 days or so, I could probably get 1, 2, 3, 4 chapters and maybe an introduction in. There's a couple of videos that I want to bring into the course. Most of the course is not going to be videos, but the first three sections I think are going to be videos. And they're very, very important videos. But I'll do the introduction first and then bring in three videos. And then after that, I will bring in the chapters 1 and 2. 2 is pretty much done. I think I just got to finish perfecting it. All that work is done. I just got to go back through it. Chapter 1 is just about almost done, too. Again, that has to be perfected. So, again, I think 5 days, I might be able to get 5 or 6 heavy-duty parts into that course, open it up, and then I will work to try to keep ahead of that course. Okay, so, and if someone catches up with me and I haven't got another chapter in and they get stopped, they'll get a note saying that the course is still being constructed at this point, and it should come up pretty quickly. We'll probably release emails every time we move to the next chapter, get another chapter in, we'll send emails saying, hey, we got this, we got that. And this will let the people know. For the newer people or for people who haven't started any courses yet, you should take the other two courses. And again, no one should skip that civil course. That civil course is powerful because it really expresses and explains how we got to where we are today. But the constitutional course, which is really a course on, it's a very simple course. It's only about 6 hours long, maybe 8. I think it's 6 hours. But it's a very simple course. It gives you the basics. On this course, the third course that we're putting up soon, this is going to be extremely in-depth on everything, on political processes and how we take that system back, on the judicial process, how we take that system back. And we're going to get involved in a lot of things. I started a list out before, but my mind's running a blank at the moment, there's a lot of things going to go on. And we'll make a list of things and get that up there, too, so people can kind of get a view of what's coming up, what chapters are coming up. But the chapters will have to be taken chronologically. You must finish a chapter and take the test at the end of the chapter to move to the next chapter. It's not a difficult test. It's very simple, really. The point of the test is to really make sure that the people have taken the course, you know, taken work, did the work. And it gets you stimulated to ask yourself questions, to go back and review what you've read or what you heard, and kind of helps put it into your brain, you know. And so if you get, if you got 10 questions at the end of a chapter, and you get 8 right, the 8 right will stick, and you'll know that 2 are wrong, and you got to get the answers to those 2. And once you get that, you move on to the next. And it's multiple choice, too, so it really kind of is real simple anyway. But again, you know, you're here to learn, and the whole thing, and the whole process, anybody who cheats through the system is only cheating themselves because they're not getting anywhere with it. The point is to spend time with material, reading and learning. And remember, there are 2 things. First of all, it's extremely interesting stuff, okay? So interesting. That, you know, I know for me, as learning this stuff, I can't wait to get back for more. Even still now, I mean, I'm still learning, and I just can't wait to get back for more because it's so fascinating and interesting. Common law is fascinating. What our founding fathers did and put together in our nation, the construction of our nation, our history, all fascinating stuff. So that's what it's all about. And so it's fascinating to begin with. But the rule of thumb that I have is... I don't struggle to try to remember anything. I don't even usually do with notes. I just talk. But I don't try to remember anything. I try to understand something. And if there's something in there I don't understand, I stay with it until I understand it before I move on, because maybe something's important coming up, and this is true all the time. Maybe something important's coming up, and if you don't have that prerequisitional understanding of a certain thing, you can't get the next thing, okay? But also, if you work at things that way, to understand things, the other side of that coin is you'll never forget it, okay? Sometimes you may have a tough time kind of finding it and pulling it out. That's okay. But enough of this stuff you keep putting in, the connections are made, you know? The brain cells are connecting and all this stuff is connecting. Before you know it, you're drawing on stuff that you read and looked at and forgot about 3 years ago or 6 months ago. All of a sudden, it just falls out of your mouth, and you say, wow, where did that come from? You know? And that's how the brain works. You just understand. Matter of fact, I put a program up on, what do we call this? It was under the tab called Reality Check on the blue bar. If you go into Reality Check, there is a link there called The Brain. If you click on that, it's, I think, 6 parts. Yeah, it's a 6-part video. What a fascinating video. I disagree with his crazy conclusion at the part 6. They got this crazy idea. They think that they can download a brain. They're working on it, and I do believe they could. And they're mapping out the brain. They think in 2 or 3 years they're going to be able to download a brain onto a drive. But remember, you'll only get pure evil. You'll get the fleshly part of the brain. You won't get the conscious, because the conscious is your soul. That's not part of your physical being. That is the you. And you're not going to be able to download a soul or a heart, the you, you know? But anyway, Jan, let me move on. So anybody who wants to really kind of understand those things, that watch those videos. They're fascinating.
Hey, John, yes, before Jan comes on, I just want to make this announcement. These 3 new videos on the front page with David Barton, Capital 4 with David Barton that John just downloaded, One Nation Under God, and 4 Traps of False History. That's something everybody should go watch. It'll really open up your eyes into
it. That was fascinating, wasn't it?
Oh, it was really good. Really good
stuff. It really opened. I couldn't believe how much. And I'm a Bible teacher, for 30 years plus now. And there were some things that I missed. I didn't realize how much. I was blown away by those videos, man.
Yeah, so I just wanted to mention them, that they're up there. They're the last video, the last three videos on our welcome page, you know. And I don't know, there's six or seven videos up there, but anyway, it's the last three.
Well, it's the last three ones are the most important, yeah.
Right.
Actually, the last four. You know, there's four of them, because there was one there that's been up there for quite some time with that monument up there.
Yeah, our forefathers' monument. Yep, that was good.
Yeah.
So from there down, and one of them's pretty short, and one of them's a lot longer. But look at it, like John said, they're very interesting. You won't be bored. All right, I rest.
Okay, Jen.
No, okay.
Terry.
John, I've been talking to Jan, and Jan had to run about an hour and a half into it. And so he gave me the question, and he gave me the one announcement. And I'd like to ask the question, when does a presentment become an indictment? Please explain the difference in detail.
Well, presentments are something that the grand jury does totally on its own. An indictment is something that is produced to them by another person, usually a prosecutor. But it doesn't have to be a prosecutor. You know, we do indictments for two reasons. First of all, the grand jury isn't necessarily exploring it out on their own. It's we the people out here in National Liberty Alliance putting this together and bringing the case together to produce and give to the grand jury. And we place it up on our website, and the grand jury, whoever's going to participate in the grand jury, for anybody that may be new, anybody can participate with the grand jury. We send an email out when the grand jury is going to meet, usually a few emails, start a couple of weeks before and build up to the meeting coming up for the grand jury to meet to discuss a certain case. But we constantly put out the page on where the information is that people need to study, look at, whether it's watching some videos, reading materials and different things, the evidence, in order for them to make a decision whether they want to indict or not, and also which individuals they would like to agree with an indictment on. So it's produced to the grand jury by we the people, and then the grand jury gives an indictment or not. If during that, or if the sheriff brings it to them, again, it's an indictment. Now, if the grand jury, in the process of doing their duty, and they discover something sort of off, out of left field, maybe something they were looking into led them someplace else, and they said, hey, we need to look at this, and then they would move to the administrators to get access. We would make sure they'd have access to whatever it is they want access to, and they can do their own investigation. And in that investigation, they decide, well, okay, let's bring it before the whole grand jury, and they produce it to themselves, and that's called a presentment. It's as valid and as powerful as an indictment. It's just called, it just has a different name. That's all it is. So that's the difference between the two. And when the administrators work in the county, and they're doing their job of orientating the grand jury, orientating the trial juries, making sure that they're not tainted, watching, making sure that no one violates them or tries to stack them or any of those things, okay? Well, also, those administrators are also investigators for the grand jury. And so they may get the call from someone in the county. And remember, those four individuals are not on the grand jury. They are people. They represent we the people. And if people want to come and talk to the grand jury, well, they can talk to the administration of the grand jury, and maybe we can fix the problem. Maybe we can make a few phone calls and settle it. And if we can't do that, then let it be known that, okay, we're going to send it to the grand jury. We give it to the grand jury. They can review it, and then they can have these people come before them. They could try to fix the problem, you know. And if they can't, then they'll maybe decide to do an indictment and send it to the trial jury for final decision. So there's always a process. We could try to always keep it out of the court and settle the problem, because remember, the purpose of this whole judicial process is to fix the person that's harmed. Remember, the main point to this whole thing, if you want to talk about common law in just a few words, it's this simple: do no harm. There's nothing more difficult than that. Do no harm. So if someone's been harmed, The question that the administrators might want to ask themselves to discover where they want to go from there, or the grand jury would want to ask themselves on where they want to go from there, or even the trial jury want to ask themselves on where they're going to go from there is, number one, has someone been harmed? Number two, who likely harmed them? And number three, how can we fix this? Okay, we're not here to punish the person per se, but the process requires a punishment just naturally, because you have to fix the person you injured, and that's the punishment. And that person may have to live very, very humble for a long period of time to earn a lot of money to be able to give a monetary value to the person they injured. I don't know. Violence is a different thing. We have to look at it from a couple of different perspectives. You know, there's the death penalty on murder and different things. The kidnapping is also, of course, we can look at incarceration for someone who is extremely violent. And again, it's something we have to think about and pray about on how we're going to work. And I think we need to investigate that more on how to deal with that problem, because prison is not something really that we should be too involved with. And again, the other thing is we need to get rid of a lot of these prisons. If people do go to jail, they need to go to jail in their county. That's where the county jail is for. You don't want to send them six states away if they're federal, or 300 miles away if it's state, and you're cutting them off from support, their families, their children. You know, all of that is part of trying to bring the person back into society to kind of restore that individual. If a prison sentence is necessary. And again, I think that's really on very, very rare cases people need to be in prison. But it's something I think we the people need to debate, think about. We need to research, see what our founding fathers did, see what the biblical principles and what was done in the Bible, how did they solve problems like that, and look a little deeper. But anyway, I went way past the question.
Okay. And then secondly, Gary Will has an update on the Welcome Committee. Let me unmute him.
How you doing, Gary?
Well, my unmute didn't seem to work. Let me go find him again.
Tell him to get into the queue. Get into the queue, Gary. Star 6. And then we'll unmute you there.
Okay.
Gary,
can you hear me?
We can hear you, Will.
Okay. Yeah, I'm happy to let you know we got the new Welcome Committee page up. If you go on National Liberty Alliance, we encourage everyone to log in, new and old alike. And if you go to the Members tab on the blue bar and go down to Welcome to NLA, it'll go through six parts.
By the way, Gary, do I have to do any more work on that? Do we need any more correction or anything adding on that?
Yes, I sent a Skype to you several days ago.
Yeah, I've cut everything off. My Skype went down on me. I was wondering why I didn't get any calls for a long. I found I couldn't open my Skype. I had to reboot my computer. So that was one thing. But I was ignoring calls anyway for the past 3 or 4 days because we really had to get this paperwork done. But we'll try to deal with that. Maybe the day after tomorrow we'll find time for that. But go ahead. Finish off what you're saying.
Okay. Like I said, there's six parts. The first part, we go into the mission. That's very critical. Most people don't really understand our mission. John and Gerard covered it tonight. The political and the judicial processes. But if we understand the mission, then we'll get the vision to stick with it and complete the task. In part two, we go into who is NLA, their history. In part three, we call it the transformation. That goes into a little deeper history. And part four is just the basics in American law. Part five is the law of the land. And part six is members orientation, which includes a lot of videos. It's mainly videos. But all of these steps are, I would encourage all the old members as well as the new, of course, definitely the new members, that should be where they go to get started. because that'd give them the background, and it'll reaffirm the old members' background in a lot of things that they may have forgotten. And it moves quite smoothly. We include videos and so on to kind of break it up. It's a crash course. It's quite moving, but we don't sell it short as a result of that. And it'll give us information we need that we can take a stand in our communities and defend ourselves, we're hoping. And like I say, we've added videos to complement the course, including the ones that Gerard mentioned earlier on David Barton. Those are excellent videos. You can find them where he mentioned, or it's part of our course. So you can get it both places. And during the course, we cover constitutional rights versus unalienable rights. We cover admiralty law, basic, you know, just basic coverage, and republic versus democracy, and so on. So it gives you a real firm background on just a base knowledge on everything you really need to know to defend yourself at the school board meeting or wherever you may go. Because if everyone followed the Constitution, we wouldn't have all of these statutes and codes that we have now to regulate our behavior. And so that's essentially what it is. Again, it's located on the members tab on the blue bar. Go down to Welcome to NLA, and on the flyout menu, all the parts will be shown. And I think you'll find it exciting. We'll welcome your feedback. If you're happy with it, let us know. If you're not, let us know. And there are a few little changes to be made that John's got to do. But essentially, it's done. It's just maybe highlighting something or a comma or something of that nature. So it's done. It's available to everyone. And, of course, we encourage everyone to go through it. And if especially the older people, if you see something you're familiar with, just skip it. But I think it'll give you a good background. And, of course, new people, we really want you to go through there. And the end result is we steer everyone into the Constitution course. And that's a course everyone should have. If you don't know your Constitution, is pretty hard to defend it. And if you don't know your rights, it's pretty hard to defend them. So we hope in the first phase to essentially respond to those problems. And then we'll have some other parts that we'll be adding later on. If Ron's
hey, Gary,
on
how's...
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. How's the calling going? Have you been got back to that? Is that in operation now?
Well, we've selected a couple hundred people that we're going to be calling. I'll let Ron.
I don't know if you noticed, if you got the latest list, but over the weekend we picked up 60 new members.
Yeah, that was a good result of your radio program.
Right. Yeah, that was a YouTube thing. But yeah, hopefully we'll be called back. She said that she'd like to talk with us again, so we'll go back. And again, we're looking to talk anywhere to anyone who will listen. Anybody knows of any radio or YouTube or whatever, you know, internet radio. It doesn't matter if they want to hear us and what we're doing. We'll speak and answer anybody's questions and give them a synopsis of what we're doing and how we're doing it. So we need to get the word out. We need the people to step up because whatever you're doing, keep doing it. But you need to get behind this movement and you need to get educated. Without education, you really can't get anything done. And remember what Jefferson said, if the people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. Of course, that's a paraphrase, but it's not going to happen. Anyway, anything else, Gary?
Yeah. We will be starting calling people. and getting that going also. We have the list and so on. I think Ron Flick's on the line. If you'd like to, if you can unmute him, maybe he can fill in some points that I didn't cover. He's been very much involved in this. And
Ron, if you want to talk, get into the queue. Star 6 to get into the queue, and we'll unmute you if you want to talk.
Go ahead. But anyway, it's moving along pretty good at this point, and I think we're going to see that kind of influx down the road a little bit, because that was a good week, 50-some people. That's more than we brought in a long time.
Oh, yeah. 989, is that Ron's area code?
I don't believe so.
Okay, because I see a 989 in there, but no name next to it. So I don't know if Jim wanted. Did you have anything to announce? I unmuted you, Jim. Do you have anything you wanted to announce?
Yeah, I actually wanted to make sure that everybody knew that you guys were going to be on the Randy Yarborough show on the 17th.
Oh, I am? Great.
Yes, this Thursday.
What time?
Well,
Thursday.
I left
what
notes
time?
In your Skype. I left notes in
yeah,
your Skype, but now I realize
been,
your
I
Skype
been,
is down.
I have been tardy. And, I know that you got some paperwork done for me over the weekend. I'm going to try to download that tonight or tomorrow morning and get I got three to go out, I think?
I think there are three.
Okay, so I'll get them out probably tomorrow maybe, okay?
All
and,
right, just send me confirmation. Reply back.
Yeah, as soon as I download it and get them into the envelopes ready for mailing, I'll give you a call. So I've been ignoring not only you, I've been ignoring a lot of people. I just had to do it. My phone rings so much, and both between my online phone and my cell phone even now, that I can't even retrieve messages because I have to. They fill up once or twice a day, and I just leave them filled up. I just don't answer. People have to be lucky to get me, or they're not at all. And sometimes I just have to shut the phone off in order to get work done. I just can't get anything done. But I'll get to you probably tomorrow. And I know Crystal is here, too, and I know I was supposed to get in touch with her last week, but I had so many emergencies going on, not only with what we're writing and doing, but also personal emergencies with family members or close friends and so on. So just people pulling me everywhere, and I don't even know if I'm all together in one piece anymore. So, but anyway, we'll deal with it.
John?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I had some, okay.
Ron is on the call.
I don't see his name anywhere. He's got to get into the queue, star 6 to get into the queue, and hopefully he's got his name next to him because, is he a 989 number is the question.
No, I think he's 501.
Jim, did you want to say anything else? Did you have an announcement?
Well, I wanted to make sure that Jan was there, but I heard he wasn't. So
yeah,
maybe I can tell Terry to make sure that they update the website for the times on that. And Jan should have them times.
Okay, we'll update them for a Randy Yarborough show.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you can read it, I'm away from my desk right now. I think it was 6 o'clock. I think that might be our time.
Okay.
I'm not really sure. I'd have to
look
at the email
again. 6 p.m. Eastern?
I believe so.
Yeah, I think it was 6 p.m. last time.
Yeah.
So 6 p.m. Eastern. And Brent is going to be running that radio program?
I'm sure he is. I've talked to him
about
it, too.
Well, I'll talk with him in a minute, so...
I'll get off.
Else. Okay. All right. Yeah, I still don't see Ron, so unless Ron can get a number.
He gave me a Skype, and he said we still need volunteers in California, Oregon, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, Kansas, Minnesota, Texas, Kentucky, Tennessee, Mississippi. But anyway...
And you need volunteers, tell the people for what now, to make phone calls, right?
To make phone calls, we need people to help us in that effort. There's not that many calls. We need to call these new people, like John mentioned, 50-some came in this week. and probably another 50 next week, and we're a couple months behind. So we need a few people in those states. We're trying to hit them with what we have now, but if we have anyone on the call in any of those states, we'd appreciate it if you'd help us out, and I imagine it would take you an hour, 2 hours a week for the first week to call the new people, but then we're going to call others also. But if you could step up for the next 2 to 3 weeks, that'd be great.
Okay. All right, if that's it, let me move on with the program.
Okay.
Okay. Gerard, are you ready to take the panel?
Sure.
Okay,
is
give me
Brent
a minute
here
before we
tonight?
Do that. I'm going to look for Brent first.
Okay.
Brent, are you here?
Yes, Brent is here. Yeah, he's here.
Brent, can you unmute yourself? Is he coming in as a...
No, I'm unmuted, yeah.
Oh, there he is. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, before we get started, Brent, real quick, I guess the show you're going to be doing this Thursday, you're going to be running that show?
Yes.
On the radio? Okay.
Yes.
Maybe we could try to move towards more of a Q&A thing. You know, maybe we can get people on the radio to call in if that's possible. I don't know. Is that live? Are we doing it live or is it recorded? It is. Okay.
It's
so maybe
live.
We can get some call-ins. And maybe you can kind of write some questions. We've been on that show enough that maybe we could just go right to Q&As, you know. I can give like a 5-10 minute quick view, overview, and then we can go right to Q&A, okay?
Well, I'm pretty sure that Q&A will work. I'll double check, but I think that that's normal on that show.
All right, if not, we can improvise. We got plenty to talk about, so. And you can
right.
ask questions.
No, and
too,
you've got plenty to say. You've got plenty to say, John. That's the good thing about it.
Okay. All right. Well, let me introduce you, and we'll get going with the program, and then we'll move into Q&A after this. I know I ran long today, and we do from time to time. I run long when we have something new going on, and we kind of read some stuff and get involved in some things. But generally, we don't get to – by this point, we're well into Q&A. But anyway, right now, let's move over to Brent Winters. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law, and his website is commonlawyer.com, and Brent's going to continue teaching us on the Declaration of Independence. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you. And my comments may or may not be the position of National Liberty Alliance. I speak for myself, but as always, I enjoy and appreciate them letting me say a few things. Well, before we start, we'll start by doing this. Before we start right into the Declaration of 76, I was thinking, as the question was brought up about Amendment 5, which says this is of our Constitution of the United States, says, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury. There are only two ways to bring an indictment against a man and to hold him over for trial, criminal trial in federal court. Only two ways, W-A-Y-S, and that is presentment or indictment. And the presentment is not used much anymore. And when I make a mention of what I understand about it, you'll understand why it's not much used, but it could be, and it ought to be. Criminal trial, says Article 5, must only be on presentment or indictment of grand jury. Now, these two methods, presentment and indictment, signify two different ways to bring a person to criminal trial. The words on presentment mean that the grand jury investigates a matter on its own initiative. It decides to indict and demands that the U.S. attorney draw up an indictment for the grand jury foreman to sign as a true bill. True bill means he's indicted. By the word indictment means caught by the foot. That's what it means. An indictment, well, the word impeach, even more so, I guess, really means caught by the foot, but indictment is the same thing. That word doesn't exactly mean that, but that's what it means. You catch the guy by the foot and you hold him, you try him. But you got to catch him by the foot first, and that's what a grand jury does. They say, yeah, you can hold this guy over for trial. So presentment means the grand jury investigates a matter on its own initiative. It investigates a matter the U.S. attorney doesn't ask it to investigate. Presentment means that the grand jury may decide to investigate the U.S. attorney that's trying to get them to investigate somebody else. That's happened in our past, in our history. There was a regular onslaught of that back in the 20s and 30s. People got tired of prosecutors. They also got tired of prohibition, and they started investigating the grand juries. I know. I've talked to people that know, and I've talked to people that have been involved in it. Prosecutors and judges in some parts of our country are some of the biggest purchasers of moonshine liquor. And they're the ones that get tapped into by other powerful people and told, well, you either indict this fellow on a moonshine charge or we'll have you indicted. Well, that was what was going on during Prohibition, although it was going on all over the country, not in the areas known for moonshining, which stretched from Arkansas clear to West Virginia and all parts in between, generally speaking, and maybe a few other places, but that's where it's mostly known. Well, that's presentment. That's where the grand jury does it itself. But then the other method called indictment signifies that the U.S. attorney's submission of a proposed indictment to the grand jury is signed. In other words, the U.S. attorney does the investigation. So I suppose if you were to distinguish presentment from indictment, presentment is where the grand jury does the investigation without the involvement of the U.S. attorney. Indictment is where the U.S. attorney does the investigation. The Justice Department of the United States, in other words, does the investigation, and they present all their information to the grand jury, and the grand jury then either signs off on it or they don't. The presentment method, where the grand jury does its own investigation, is, has been called the runaway grand jury. They see the government attaches a negative name to it to give it a bad name, as though it's a team of horses being whipped without anybody holding the reins. I've seen that happen. It can be quite destructive to people around to watch horses get plumb out of control that way. Well, that's what the runaway grand jury is supposed to be, and that is the other way, the popular way of saying presentment. Now, these words sound about the same. People wouldn't notice the difference unless somebody stopped to really consider it. But these two ways of indictment by grand jury are the ways of our common law and have been around for a long, long time, centuries. When our Constitution was drafted, when they said presentment, everybody knew what that meant. When they said indictment, everybody knew what that meant. Just like when they said trial by jury, everybody knew what that meant. And there's nothing explained in our Constitution because it's a brief. And the words, to the minds of those in that day that read it, the words of our Constitution and our Declaration of 76 freighted all they wanted it to freight. And that was quite a bit, and people were conversant with those matters. Well, I think I'll mention, no, I'm going to go straight to the rest of our, to the Declaration of 76, and if I have time, I'll mention these other things. I enjoy listening to everybody's comments, and the more John spoke tonight, the more my mind was stimulated with things to say, and I like it that he talks before I do because he impels me to so many things, but I'll try to be disciplined and stick with our Declaration of 76 because we are moving through it, clause by clause and blow by blow, and while I'm talking, hoping I can find where I left off last time, I lost it because I was down there in the Constitution, and I'm reduced to doing like they did centuries ago before they had books. They used scrolls, and when I get my computer up, that's what I do, I scroll. We're going backwards in one way while we're going forwards in technology in another. Okay, here we go. Paragraph 24, that's where we left off. Now, paragraph 15 through paragraph 24 begin with each paragraph begins with the word for, F-O-R. So that's different. The rest of it begins with the rest of the paragraphs in the body of the document begin with he. Well, the reason these paragraphs here, about nine of them, I believe, they begin with for is because they're all subsections to this statement. I'm going to read to you in paragraph 15. Everything before paragraph 15 is he did this, he did that, talking about King George III. And paragraph 15 says, he has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution. And remember we had said that's a small c, Constitution. There was no United States Constitution at that time. And their Constitution, they understood, was their common law. And by the way, our Constitution today is still our common law. And our U.S. Constitution is just a slice, just a small slice of the due processes, the ways, the means, the courses that are to be taken to do things, respecting specifically the general government in Washington, D.C. Well, it says, he has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation. Well, what pretended legislation? Well, then all these fours begin. What kind of pretended legislation? Pretended legislation for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, paragraph 16. Pretended legislation for protecting them by mock trial. And it says in paragraph 18, pretended legislation for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world. 19, pretended legislation for imposing taxes without our consent. 20, paragraph 20. Pretended legislation for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury. And then 21, pretended legislation for transporting us beyond the sea to be tried for pretended offenses. I use that word to death. And then 22, pretended legislation for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province. Remember, that was Quebec. And that the Quebec Act of Parliament extended Quebec clear down to the Ohio River. And put in place the canon law of Rome. Amazing. It's just utterly amazing. Just the arrogance and the grabbing of power, it's beyond, as they say, over the top. And then we get to paragraph 23, pretended legislation for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, altering fundamentally our forms of governments. Well, this is amazing, isn't it? See, what we call our revolution, it wasn't a revolution. It wasn't revolving around and around. It was just saying, look, we got a government here in America. We like our government. We don't want to change it. So quit trying to take it away from us. You see, that's different. All the other revolutions that occurred after what was called the Papal Revolution of the 10th century, the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and many other petty revolutions around Europe and the world, all of those revolutions says we want to get rid of our government. We want to get rid of those people that are governing us. We want to have a new form of government. Well, for all the talk even our founders made of having a Stabwell, our Declaration of 76 says that, but that's all theory. They're just saying people have a duty to do that if they need to have a new form, but we didn't get a new form. What the Americans wanted to do was reach back into the past and establish something that they thought had been lost. Well, it had been. Oh, well, Britain was trying to take it away from the Americans, but they weren't trying to do anything new. Isn't that amazing? And that's, what, by the way, why it lasted, because after we had our break from England, we just continued the way we had been before. We had the same courts, the same state legislatures. How wonderful. That's why it was all stability. It wasn't tottering and unstable like it is in all the rest of the law of the city world. We had the law of the land. And I dare say today, there'd be a lot of counties in the United States that'd be good to just close their doors, close the courthouse doors and go home. Just forget it. They have been so infested with so much filth and trash and corruption, stealing, devouring widows' houses all over the country since the banking debacle. It's pandemic at this point. It'd be good just to close the doors. People say, oh, my, we have to have government. We can't. You can't get rid of government. You could shut down all the county governments in the country. You could shut down every state government. Do you think there wouldn't be government? Listen, if you shut down every state government in the country, no, let's say this. If you shut down the federal government of the United States, the general government, do you think there'd be no government in this country? No. The state governments would continue just like they did before, probably only better. And the county governments would continue. The taxing powers would continue in the states to collect taxes. They would make provisions for their money. Each state would make provisions for its own defense. There would be a meeting, a national meeting of the Association of Governors, and they'd hold it together, probably and maybe better than before. They would probably, my guess is, that there would be a consensus, and they would all just take the Constitution of the United States and say, well, let's follow this best we can. If I were governor, that's what I'd want to do, and I would imagine others would, because if they did, they'd be facing sure destruction because the rest of the world would want to be pouncing on us to pick up the pieces, and they would form themselves into a coalition quickly. Well, we're already in a coalition. As a matter of fact, we wouldn't even have to form ourselves. But on the other hand, if the county governments went away, the other counties around them would fill in. There is always a filling in of the void of the lack of government. And wherever there are men, that void will be filled. And we are fortunate in our own country that we've got all these states and these separate jurisdictions and these counties. And we can talk about the bad things. I can do that too. And there are bad things, but the power is dispersed. And that's our strength, because the power is dispersed among states, counties, local water districts, school districts, irrigation districts, communities of religious order, and all different kinds of churches, some of them in their own way very powerful, very influential. That's all splitting the power. Then families have power. Wealthy people have power. People that aren't wealthy have power without wealth because of influence. And on it goes. You have influence right where you are. Don't wait till some deed of greatness you may do. Do not wait to spread your light afar. To the many duties ever near you, now be true. Brighten the corner where you are. You have tremendous potential right where you are. Don't think for a moment you don't. In fact, that is what makes it all work for the best of everybody. The spheres of authority that you may have, maybe all you have is just you and your house, or maybe all you have is just you and wherever you are. Maybe you don't even have a house. But you have been given jurisdiction from the Creator to do what he tells you to do. In your own way, humbly do it. And it will be multiplied, because little is much. Little is much when God is in it. Well, let's get to paragraph 24. He says, for suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. Remember, he's saying that they're passing, paragraph 15, this is paragraph 24, paragraph 15 says that they are passing the parliament, the king is signing off on it, pretended legislation for suspending our own legislatures. By legislation of parliament, they were saying, we're suspending your legislature there in America. And we're declaring ourselves 3,000 miles away, parliament. We're saying we're the ones, we have all the power to legislate for you folk over there 3,000 miles away in all cases whatsoever. Now that's pretended legislation. See, what they wanted to do was just shut government down in the United States. That's what they wanted to do. That's what the federal courts and the federal government and the Congress is trying to do constantly. Strip the states of power. Just strip them little by little if need be, but take away their power of legislation. Our common law requires self and local government. The closer to home, the better. And by using the pronoun themselves up here in this paragraph 24, declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. This, as I've said, harks back to paragraph 15. Now, the East India Company agents in that day, East India Company, Exchequer revenuers, that's what they call today in England the Inland Tax Service. They call it the Inland, that means inside of England, Tax Service. We call it the Internal Revenue Service, same thing. It used to be called the Exchequer Revenue. Then clerks and dependents, beneficiaries of British mercantilism. That's what we were at war against, really. See, at that time, the British East India Company was the government in the country we today call India. The King of England and Parliament had nothing to do whatsoever with what went on in India. But the Indians were governed with a heavy hand by this company that had a monopoly grant from the Crown and from Parliament, called the East India Company. They had a monopoly grant of trade with India. And they had set up, they were powerful, they were rich, they had set up a government in India that was a corporate government. You talk about international corporate power. Well, the East India Company wanted to do the same thing here to us. Now, the difference was, and they told the Americans, you can't trade with anybody but us. East India Company. But the difference was the people that lived in America were British. The people that lived over in India were not. The people that lived over in India didn't have a clue what common law was. They never experienced it. Well, the people in America not only had they experienced it, it was part of their psyche. Part of their psyche. You know, there was one common law country in Africa. And it was there because a colony of emancipated slaves from America decided they wanted to go back to Africa, and the government was willing to help them, and they founded a country called Liberia. Liberia. And Liberia, when they went back, they brought their common law with them. They left America. They were used to the common law. They took it back to Liberia. And until very recently, Liberia was a common law country, had been for a long, long time. Other forces came in, and Islam being among them, and it's been a mess there and since recent years. But where the common law goes, it brings order, because with it, it brings the Bible. It's part of our common law, as Justice Story says. Well, like Marxism, mercantilism, that's what governed the British Empire back when our country was founded. Like Marxism, mercantilism says that a man or a country will profit only by the loss of others. You can only profit by taking what someone else has. That is the fundamental of the evil empire. I don't care what the label is, Marxism, mercantilism, Islam, collectivism, socialism. These are all the same thing, fundamentally the same thing. And they say fundamentally, unless we take all the wealth and even things out, take from one and give to another, people can't have what they need. There's only so much to go around. That seems sensible enough. As some people say, it works out on paper, great. Trouble is, it just never works, period. Of course, the reason it never works, because those that are in power and can control resources, they can't resist stealing them for themselves and doing with them what they want. And then add to that the idea that there is not a limited number of resources. It makes sense to believe that, but it is not true. Abe Lincoln predicted by this time in history, 2020, even before 2020, he said more like around, he penciled it out. He did a good job of figuring the math, and he said by the year 2000, we will have upwards of 300 million people in our country. And in his, that was a big increase, because there were only about 30 million in his day. 30 million people. That went to 300 million. He predicted it would happen. It was just a matter of doing the math exponentially. How do you feed and clothe 300 million people when there were poor people in America at 30 million people? Well, we have technology. Oh, that's a lot of it. I understand that. But history, if there's anything it's shown, just the opposite of what the naysayers say. The more people they are, the more exponential the production. We have in America today, with over 300 million people, much more than what we had by per capita, even when my parents were alive. When my parents were alive, I used to look at the pictures. People didn't wear shoes in this warm weather. The reason they didn't wear shoes is because they wanted to save their shoes for winter. It was too hard to get them. People work less now, less labor, and our abundance is overwhelming. And it all comes down to getting it out of the ground, getting the natural resources out of the ground. If there's freedom to do that, there will be abundance beyond anything we can ever use. The oil scare back in the 70s, we're running out of oil in the 80s and the 90s. The largest oil reserve discovered in the history of the United States, North America, was discovered up in North Dakota recently. And now another field, and I've been in this field down in West Texas. It's incredible what's going on down there. The West Texas, nobody lives out there. It's crawling with people, thousands upon thousands of men. They're drilling oil and gas like mad, bigger than the one they found in North Dakota. You say, well, it's got to run out sometime. Well, maybe, but on the other hand, there's no end in sight. God has made it that way. It's all in his plan. He wants us to multiply, be fruitful. And by the way, Lincoln pointed this out. For whatever else he may have done was right or wrong, he had his arithmetic right on this. And it is true that if population is not rising, the economy fails. That's always been true throughout the recorded history of mankind. If population is increasing, the economy is vibrant. If population stabilizes, it won't stabilize. It'll either be going up or down. And when it's going down, the country will collapse. Period. And there's no fixing it. You ask people why? I've heard all sorts of answers. Nobody really can put their finger on it. It's just the way it is. Could it be that God said to multiply and that he knows and nobody else does and it works? Well, seems like maybe there's something to the reality of fact. And that brings up another thing I want to mention here. We're talking about, in a roundabout way earlier, natural law. And natural law is an important question. I remember when Judge Thomas, they were trying to put him on the bench, and they crucified, like he said, they lynched him. It was like lynching of the black man in earlier years. They lynched him. And he had said at that time that he had looked into what he called natural law in his early days, and whatever he said about natural law, they tried to attack him. They said, do you believe there's a natural law? Well, that was a big attack on him and during his confirmation hearings, that he was stupid enough, backward enough, old-fashioned enough to think that there was some kind of a natural law outside of men making law. Now, he does believe that, but there's an important distinction that the evil empire and the evil one is very clever in obscuring the meanings of words. Justice Thomas is a Roman Catholic, a very staunch one, trained as a Roman Catholic. And natural law to him is scholasticism. Some people call it Thomism. The writings of the man known as St. Thomas Aquinas, Thomism. And his writings were, in his idea, were the paragon of tightly logicked reason. Natural law to the Romans, and that's the official doctrine of Rome today, natural law to the Romanists always has been, even before Rome gained power, Babylonianism has always been scholasticism. What is the law of nature to them? It is the ability to reason. Well, that's not the law of nature, unfortunately. That's man's manufacturing of what he says it is. That's not what the Bible says it is. And that's not what history and nature present to us. The natural law, the laws of nature, and the laws of nature's God, when that phrase is put in our declaration, natural law was simply this. It's the way things are, and they won't change. As the popular phrase today would say it, it is what it is. You may not think it's logical. It may not be logical to you, but fact is fact. Why do things happen that way? Well, we don't know, but that's the way they happen, so we're going to follow that. Why does spring come when it comes and fall comes when it comes, says the farmer? I don't know. Don't really care. I'll just plant in the spring and harvest in the fall, and I'll get along fine. If the state legislature said to do it the other way around, we're all going to starve. And by the way, state legislatures will do stupid things like that. And so will the Congresses of the United States. They'll do stupid things like that. People in government saying it so doesn't change it. That's what natural law is. Natural law is the way things are, and they will not change. The way things are in nature, in the heavenly bodies and the movements of them, the way things are down here on the land, the way things are in the relationships between men and men, in the relationships between men and things, there are just some things that won't change, and they become, we recognize them, they don't become, we recognize them as law. That's the laws of nature. The laws of nature are not logic. St. Thomas Aquinas, or Tom, I like to call him, he's a smart man. I've read his stuff. That man could, his mind was like a machine. Great big fella he was, they say. So big that people thought he was kind of an oaf. But that wasn't true. He had trained his mind, and his ability to use logic tightly and to not violate the rules of it was uncanny. But he came to some wrong conclusions. You know, you don't have to be a logician to, well, let me put it this way. You don't have to be a chicken to be a good judge of a good taste egg. And you don't have to be a logician to know whether a man like St. Thomas Aquinas has come to the right conclusion. I was in a case one time, and it was in a small town, and it was in a oil field kind of a place where there were a lot of oil wells. And one side put on its expert witnesses, which were professors from an engineering school not far away. And the other side put its expert witness on. It was an old fella that people around there called Oily. Oily. Well, Oily had never been to school much, but Oily had worked in the oil field all his life. And he got on the witness stand, and they tried to qualify him as an expert, and the judge said, well, you know, he's been at it a long time. We'll go ahead and listen to his expert testimony. You know, an expert testimony is a testimony. It can be about other than facts. It can be hypotheticals. It can be testimonies about prediction of what will happen given a certain set of circumstances. Most all testimony is just fact. Just plain what happened, who done it, why they do it, and just pulling the facts out. But an expert witness is about, he has the law allows him to testify concerning what he believes will happen given a certain set of circumstances. Well, the more this guy talked, the more it became apparent that he knew what he was talking about, and he didn't explain anything. He just say, well, that's not the way it works. It won't work. It won't work that way. And the other side was objecting. The judge finally said, look, he's qualified as an expert. Let's just let him talk. Don't bother him. You interrupt his chain of thought. He knows what he's talking about in the court's opinion. Let's hear what he's got to say. And he knew what would happen in any given circumstance, and he gave his testimony, and he blew the expert PhD professor out of the water, because the PhD professor, of course, was hired to say what he was saying. He sounded all very sophisticated. He had the lingo of the university-educated man, sounded like he knew what he was talking about, had the look of an intellectual, but it didn't carry the jury. So I say again, there are two views of what natural law is in the world. One of them is most pronouncedly represented in the world by what I call Thomism. Well, I'm not the only one. Other people call it that. Logic, scholasticism. That was the view, by the way, of Justice Thomas. The other one is law. This is just the way it is. And that's the natural law that our Declaration of 76 is talking about. Just the way it is. The laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things, and the laws of nature's God, written in the Bible. That's the other volume. But right now, and this is what our Declaration is focusing on, the laws of nature. It says that he is suspended. He had passed legislation in Parliament, or he was pushing it through, to suspend the legislatures in the New World, declaring themselves invested with power to legislate. You can see there the centralization. That's what we rebelled against, and we said that's not part of our common law. When the first settlement from England came to the American shores, they had been given a charter. And the weather blew them woefully off course, and they didn't land where their charter had authority. The Mayflower landed someplace else. And knowing they did not have authority over the land where they were, and not knowing how to get to it at that point, and the winter coming on fast, they sat down before they went ashore. The men sat down in the cabin of that little ship, and they drew up a document. They called it the Mayflower Compact. And using common law first principles, fitting their needs in the wilderness, they all signed it. And it is said that that was the first pronounced act of self-government in the New World by an English settlement. And the colonials agreed that common law applied on American soil. Other colonies followed suit in self-government, and for the next 166 years, Parliament, and while they were enjoying, the English were enjoying the wealth, the colonials' free relationships, contract, and trade produced, they all enjoyed that, and by silence, they agreed that the common law applied on American soil. They never bothered them for 166 years. But then, all of a sudden, they said, we've got to get control of these colonies, and they talked King George into trying to change the colony's 166-year-old course of prosperity. It was too late. You know, once you've had steak, lunch meat doesn't have the same taste. Well, that's the way they'd had a taste of self-government for 166 years. And when they came down and said, well, you've got to change, it was too late. You've got to change your ways. They had left the colonies alone. I mean, just left them alone. Can you imagine the wealth we would have in America if government would just leave folk alone? It was a quirk of circumstances and an odd set of circumstances of happenings in history that caused that to happen. Truly, the kings before King George III were his father, King George II, and his grandfather, King George I. Well, King George I and King George II were Germans, and they were more interested in German beer and German girls than the Fraulein's, no, the Frau's, they call them. Then they were more interested in those than they were in being king. And it is said they always though showed up in England when they get the paycheck, and then they go back again. Now, wouldn't it be nice? People laugh at all the shenanigans that government officials pull. It wouldn't it be nice if we could just pay them to do nothing? And they'd probably get in trouble. But the trouble with these fellows is they want to fill their lust like King George I and II, drink and do drugs and chase girls. But they don't want. But they want to govern too. They want to tell everybody what to do. See, well, these fellows, they were off doing things they hadn't ought to be doing. But in doing that, they left the colonies alone. They paid no attention, and that's why the colonies became such a powerful engine of wealth, and of course, remained so after the Revolution. Some people say, "Oh, we need regulation." Really? You know, during the time of the American Revolution, you couldn't even if you got caught with a bag of wool within 50 miles of the coast of England, anywhere, all around that island, anywhere, 50 miles within the coast, if you were in possession of a bag of wool, you'd be arrested and thrown in jail. And if you did happen to have a bag of wool within 50 miles of the coast, and you happened to have a certain writing on it, in letters, by the way, that Parliament said had to be a certain size, had to be stamped on that burlap sack, with all of the technical things that they said it had to have, well, then they might let you get away with being within 50 miles of the coast. You see, what they were trying to do was control all of the wool going out of England. That's the kind of oppression they were under over there. But they still did pretty well because they weren't depending on themselves to make wealth, produce wealth. They were depending on us. The American colonies were just free as could be, and they were free to make contracts. They didn't stop and wait for permission about anything. They didn't worry about that. They just, as one famous man said after that, they just made sure they were right, and then they charged ahead. That's the kind of a country I envision. I hope that it comes back to that. But it's going to take an intervention from outer space, from the God of heaven, to make it happen. I believe at this point we're in pretty deep. Well, I've been talking now for, I didn't even look at the clock, but it's been about long enough. Again, thank you, John and Gerard. And I look forward to the interview Thursday. We'll ought to have fun. Back to Gerard, if you're there, back to you.
Okay, thank you, Brent. I appreciate that. I go ahead and we got a few people in a few minutes, so we'll take who we can. So I have Crystal from Connecticut. Go ahead, Crystal, if you're still with us. It's pretty late for you now. Are you there? She's been waiting so patiently in there. We've been putting her to sleep every week.
Usually much for me.
I'm going to go ahead and we're going to open up Rhonda from Indiana. I'll leave Crystal open in case we can wake her up here.
Hello.
Hello. Who's that?
Hello.
Who do we got? Hello.
Hi, this is Crystal.
Oh, hi, Crystal. What's going on? Can you hear me?
Can you hear me? This is Rhonda from Indiana.
Hang on a minute, Rhonda. I got Crystal coming in. I'll catch you just in a second.
Okay.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Crystal. Or did it... Oh, wait a minute. She's muted again.
Oh.
There you go. Go ahead, Crystal.
Okay. What's been going on up here? All right, I got my deed, I got my quit claim, life use and everything, and the judge said, we're taking your house. So we were in court, and I met about 15 people, so I gave them the National Liberty Alliance. I've been sitting in the courtrooms as also their court observer. And everybody's following police reports against the courts, the judge, and the attorneys, because they've been fraudulently stealing, and this is happening all over. Another thing we found out, and I guess it's happening to people near and far, they're changing people's mortgages, okay? Like, for example, this one guy who's also, this stood last week, he had his property in his name, and we've been following different paperwork. His accountant told him, he goes, oh, you moved. Well, they got the new owner, and they said you abandoned your property. So they're stealing people's property like a year in advance, and the people are like, wait a minute, when did we get this? And what they've been doing is changing and stealing people's mortgages. Are changing their property, and the people have not received any written paperwork or nothing. And then the MERS scam, that MERS, when they sit there and change your mortgage without your permission, and that's when I've been representing myself for the past, 4 years, and they withdrew everything, but then they came right back. So I got all my paperwork. And we're all following complaints, and it's probably criminal charges. I will get those papers and things over to you, too. Okay, but everybody keep aware of that MERS. If you did sign your name, it's illegal to change anybody's mortgage. Okay.
And, very good.
But they want me out of my house. It's in the paper. And when they were looking at it, all the attorneys, they said, well, you're the sole owner. They can't do anything with this, all right? I even contacted Blumenthal's office, and I said, could you tell me about the warranty deed and the quick claim deed, which I got them both. And they gave me the warranty deeds, you're the owner and the quick claim. You quit claim it over or whatever, that's the person in charge or the owner. So I had a quit claim back over to me, and I gave myself life use for 100 years, and I left it, remained owner, they have life use, is my granddaughters, you know, for 500 years. And also you could do that too, the quit claim. You could sit there 500 years or heir property.
So all you got to do is take that deed to the sheriff and tell them that you want him there to arrest them when they come to foreclose the house. They're trespassing. You need them arrested.
But there's no sheriff here.
Whatever law enforcement official is supposed to uphold the law of the land over there in Connecticut. You got the deed. That's the proof of ownership, right?
Right. I got the mortgage.
That's all you need.
Mm-hmm.
And you tell them, look, you can go to the clerk and look it up. I'm the record I'm the owner of record.
And I did that. And the police officer, he wrote the stuff down. And I gave it right back to him. I said, did you realize it's the executive order? I will not even submit this because you are going to incriminate yourself. So I got the paper and I'm putting the packages and everything together. And I'm giving it to the first selectman, the police, the chief of police. And I'm going to file it. People are going to file it even with the feds or whatever. Okay.
Yeah, well, you better be careful because you're really pushing the envelope there and they're not going to like it very much. And you're a very big burr under their saddle right now, especially since you got other people interested and following you. That's one of the things they can't take. But, you know, it's your only defense at this point. You know, you don't want to be in there alone. Keep bringing the crowd of people if you can, because as they get more and more desperate. Now, I don't know, as far as the mortgages getting sold and changed and everything, you know, it's all contract law, and I know that they're used to switching mortgages from bank to bank to bank. And a lot of times they put that in the contract when you sign that they can sell it any time they want. But nevertheless, they can't change contract law. You know what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
if they're doing stuff like robo-signing your name, then they're breaking the law, and they know this. And
mm-hmm.
I wonder that maybe these banks are at a critical juncture now because our money is in, you know, our debt and our money are not in good shape. The American dollar is getting dumped throughout the world. And they may be doing things because we're in desperate times and they're doing desperate actions and they're trying to grab whatever they can. You know, it's probably the rats from a sinking ship syndrome. And, of course,
mm-hmm.
the people are getting caught up in that. And the lawyers, they have no morals, so they're going to do whatever they think they can get away with. There's a lot of confusion nationally. You know, there's a lot of crime and deceit and all kinds of stuff going on at the top. And so what happens is the top is not watching the bottom. So these people in these counties and these judges and these officials, and liaisons with these other people. You know, they're committing RICO because they're getting together and they see that they can get away with this because nobody's watching. And I think that's what's going on.
Yeah. And also with the attorneys, because the attorneys are the debt collectors. And we also found out of this WPCA, and that's for like flushing your toilet or whatever, it's only a utility bill, and it's only like 4 to 12 cents, and they're the ones who are stealing everyone's homes. So they're really doing that. Not everybody, that's when they have that big meeting about, what's his name, Judith Epstein.
Well, you know, it's a utility bill, but they're obviously in league with the town. Look, a utility bill is not a secured debt. It's not secured by your property. However, when the town gets involved in the water department and things like that, now the town attaches it to your taxes. And so then you get the full force of tax collection on a bill. In other words, a sewer bill that's run by the town, even if there's a third-party guy doing the sewer, but it's still a municipal, what do you call it?
We have that. We have the sewer bill. But we also got the
WPC. Right, but I'm saying that normally they couldn't foreclose your house for a sewer bill, but the way they're doing it is they're putting it under the auspices of the town, and the town adds it to your taxes, so it's just like you didn't pay your tax. And I don't know how legal that is either, you know?
No, but the town didn't do it. It's these attorneys that sat there and had it amended. And see, we always thought it was a regular tax bill for our write-offs. And then they said, no, you can't use it as a write-off. This bill is not even equivalent to your cell phone. So how in the world are they stealing people's houses?
You're saying the town didn't do it. Look, the town was complicit in allowing them to use the full force of the law to add it to your tax bill. The town did it because they allowed it to happen. The town should have said, no, you have to go after them personally. You're not going to stick it on our tax bill. Obviously, somebody in the town is cooperating with the corporation that's running this municipal what do you call it?
The WPC
facility or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm telling you, they are all colluding, and right now the reason that you're getting so much of this is because you can't even go to the attorney general or anybody else; they're all corrupt. The judges on the federal end are all, look what's going on nationally with President Trump and Sessions and all the pedophilia and all this other stuff. You know, you're small potatoes with your little bill and your little house, and they know that, and they're letting them grab it because when the cat's away, the mice will play, and these guys are all playing, and they have no fear of retribution or retaliation. And that's where the people need to come together and say enough, you know. They need to come into that court, and they need to sit there, and they need to demand, you know, their grievances be heard.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, you're kind of doing that, but you know, you need more people. You need, you know, you need that critical
the people are now, as I said, because I was the court observer. We've been you know, we're showing the support of each other. And as a matter of fact, there's five people on my street that they're taking. So I met them today in court.
Well, keep looking, keep going, keep getting people. Get that courthouse stuffed till they got to turn people away. That's I believe that you need to do that as much as, you know, as possible anyway. But look, just hang out there a minute, Crystal. I got Rhonda unmuted. Go ahead, Rhonda. You had a question. Let me see if we can tie this together or whatever. Go ahead.
Well, actually, the question is, I've been going in and out of court for custody of my grandchildren, but today I submitted a paper from back in 2013 where I already had power of attorney and custody of my grandson. They are running a little scared about that because it is a binding contract. My question is, if my daughter and I come up with a contract about where she would give me custody, well, we already got a custody, but the thing is, they won't accept that custody paper. But if we do a binding contract where she gives me power of attorney and all rights of the kids, would that overstep the child welfare on the children?
Did you want me to answer that?
Whoever could give me advice on that would be great.
Well, did we lose you, Gerard? We must have lost Gerard.
Oh,
but,
I'm talking a mile a minute, and I.
Okay, Dad, you got it.
I'm sorry. Almost anything can override the child welfare. You have you and your daughter have first rights to those children, mm-hmm. you know, which is property rights. They're your property, as terrible as people think that sounds, but that's exactly what this is about, is property rights. And I would do any contract that you could bring into court, because your right to contract is unlimited, and they have no reason to intervene between families. So whatever you can produce like that with powers of attorneys and contracts, I would do, because, and then, you know, at some point you may have to sue each one of them personally for acting under color law. There should be no way that they can breach that or get in between you two, you know, as far as, I mean, I don't know the particulars, and I'm not giving you legal advice as far as that goes, but mm-hmm. I'm just giving you legal precedent. And what the law says and about contracts and that, and obviously that's what they're operating under. And I would encourage you, you know, to pursue something like that, where you actually have some legal paperwork, you know, that states that. And I mean, it seems to me that it's a pretty cut and dry thing. I mean, I don't like to tell people to go to attorneys, because attorneys make everything worse, but if you can get an attorney that understands contract law and family court law, it seems to me that it would be a very easy thing to get out of. I mean, if they're stealing kids like that, then they're probably part of the child pedophilia ring. That's what I would say, and I would start accusing them of that. If there's no good reason for them to be in there, why are they in there to steal the children? What are they doing? Are they feeding this global pedophilia ring? Is that what they're doing? And I would put that in my paperwork.
I would accuse them
of stealing children for trafficking or something, because there's no reason that they should be in there.
Okay. I had a meeting today with one of the caseworkers, and I asked her about a visit with my grandson after I handed her the paperwork that I had already submitted into the court with giving me power of attorney and custody of my grandson. Yeah. And she didn't want to take it. She refused it. Well, when I asked her about my visits and how I wanted to take him to the zoo, she told me if I wanted to do that, I would have to pay the people who does the supervised visits, and I've never been charged with anything. And I said, well, what's that going to cost? She told me $14 every 15 minutes for my supervisors if I wanted to go somewhere.
Okay, why don't you just have her served with the paperwork that you have there for your grandson, the paperwork that she refused, pay a process server to serve her, and then sue her and have her arrested for kidnapping.
I've served the courts with it today because the judge wasn't in, so I served the courts with it. And I went right over to the DHR building, which is child welfare. And her lawyer, she called the lawyer, their lawyer, and she goes, yes, you can take it. She goes, well, I really don't want to take it because it's pretty legal. She goes, I'm giving you permission to bring it to me. But it was already stamped and filed today. And I've already called the...
Obviously, she's scared.
Can I say something? Can I have an incident like that? Okay, this is what I did, and we won the case on this. What I did, you ask her for her supervisor, then you ask for her supervisor, then you ask for the supervisor, all the way up to under the governor's office, okay? And you get the top people, you send them all a letter. Well, guess what? By the time they got it, now they're sitting there trickling down. The person got fired because no one wanted to sign off on it. And I wanted to swear and notice after. Go right to the top, and who's the top person?
To the top today. I did call and talk to the top director, and she's supposed to be returning my call.
Under the governor's office?
I can get a hold of the governor because I've already called her a few times.
Because everybody in every state, we have somebody that's over like the DCS for the state, okay? You got that top person, and you get all their names on down. They will sit there and say, who's in charge? Do that. Believe you me, it will work.
Oh, I've been collecting names and everything.
No, from the top person under the governor's office who they appoint. You get that person's name, their title, and then they go on down. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they're held because now all of them are involved in this. Okay?
Yeah.
And believe you me, yep. And as a matter of fact, the person that it happened to, because I think at the time Richard Blumenthal was the attorney general, and they had the whole case. The woman had a $1 million lawsuit. They dismissed the case instantly. I mean, we've had some crazy case in another one. I mean, because they're taking the kids from the homes, and they're giving certain families $4,000 a month for these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of kids are disappearing. So there's a lot of crazy stuff going on.
Yeah, it
okay,
is. It's
but
all part of
start
the child
from the top.
Yeah,
and
yep.
And ask for their
same thing.
Right.
But anyway, we're over time here, so we'll pick this up next week and bring back your results. And be
all
careful
right.
out there. God bless. Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you, everybody. Yeah.